1947, NASA launched the last of America's deep space probes. Aboard this compact starship, a lone astronaut, Captain William Buck Rogers, was to experience cosmic forces beyond all comprehension. In a freak mishap, his life support systems were frozen by temperatures beyond imagination. Ranger 3 was blown out of its planned trajectory into an orbit 1,000 times more vast, an orbit which was to return Buck Rogers to Earth 500 years later.
It's unbelievable, and it's for you. It's new. It's magic. Just unroll the Whammo Slip and Slide. Hook up to any water faucet, and the magic service goes to work. It's fast. It's easy. You glide on a thin film of water, and it makes you go like a jet. Girls glide as well as boys. Thin. Roll. It's cool summer splashing fun. Get yours today. The famous Slip and Slide by Whammo. What?
Good morning.
How are you?
Pretty good. A little sleepy still.
Oh, were you up late?
Kinda. We had a long day yesterday. A fun day, but it was a long day. We went to some wineries and went out to eat and stuff.
Yeah, I saw that dog you met.
Yeah, did you like that?
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a really cool winery. It's called Arrowhead. And they live right there, so you walk up the path and their house is on the one side and the winery room is on the other. And he was hanging out outside as a border collie. And so I went inside and tried a couple wines. And then while Karen and I went with her parents. So while they were hanging out inside talking to the owners and stuff like that, I was outside playing catch with Ian for like 15-20 minutes.
So that was the owner's dog?
Yeah.
Ah.
And they were talking saying he's those dogs need a lot of attention, like they're really smart but they need a lot of stimulation.
Yeah.
And I guess it works out good cuz the owner, she's around all day and he pretty much follows her around all day and they go on lots of walks and stuff, and plus they have a lot of land, so that gives them room to run around and stuff.
Yeah, she probably gets separation anxiety if they just put her in the house.
Yeah. Yeah, but she is good at catch.
Yeah, Harley's really good at catch. She just doesn't bring it back. She can catch almost anything midair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. So this is Geek Brunch Retrocast episode number 3. I am Oberon Ivy.
And I am Orion Myers. And I was wondering if you wanted to mix it up a little bit and end with the fourth world stuff.
Yeah, sure.
And kind of start off with some of the other stuff we've read.
Yeah, that's cool with me.
And then you had some interesting questions. I enjoyed at least the outlawed toys, the banned toys.
Yeah, I forgot when maybe I think there was an article on Yahoo about banned toys or something like that that made me think of that. So yeah, we're gonna talk about some banned toys that we played with when we were kids. And
yeah, surprised how many of them.
Yeah, I thought we might have, because, you know, you're older than I am, I thought we might have some slightly different ones, too.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that should be interesting. I found some actual text about the banning of some of the ones that I got stuff.
Very cool.
So, But yeah, this is the podcast where we don't talk about piss or shit.
That's what puts Keith to sleep, if you don't talk about it.
Yeah, that sounds dangerous.
At least he's driving.
Driving around, falling asleep. if you don't know what we're talking about, listen to the latest DC noise.
Yeah, we recorded two last night until 3 in the morning.
Dang.
It's a show about nothing.
Yeah. I figured you were up late because I noticed, I looked on Facebook when I woke up this morning and Keith was posting eBay auctions. Like, you
know, that was one whole episode. He was working on the eBay auctions.
Because you know how it says like so many hours ago.
Yeah.
So I counted backwards. I was like, damn, he was up late.
He did really good with that first auction. I think you should just start. I mean, he's doing the right pattern, I think, you know, selling all 14 issues or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He's starting with the most popular ones, which are going pretty fast. Like, I think his Detective is already moving up the charts there.
Yeah.
I'm sure his Justice League will be, too.
Mm-hmm. Those are definitely good choices. Now, is he going to keep buying those? He's just not collecting them?
Yeah, he's going to keep buying them. He's just using his money for beer.
Yeah.
Another 12-pack last night. I was like, holy crap.
Damn.
Well, no, but I mean, wondering about Brown Arrow's, calorie intake. A bottle of beer's got to have, 200-plus calories in it, doesn't it?
It probably depends on the beer, but it definitely is. That's probably still my main, like, because I eat pretty healthy, but I do drink beer also, and I think that's, that's where my calorie intake is coming from, too. but that's Brown, I mean, that's the trade-off. That's, like, that's Brown Arrow's power. That's his power source. It's like Our Man's
Miracle or whatever it's called.
Yeah, it's pills. It's a trade-off. He trades calorie intake for superpowers.
I always thought that was a crazy power. You know, to have to pop a pill every hour.
Yeah. I think they invented that before...
Drugs?
Or before, like pill poppers became an issue. Maybe this superhero that gets his power from injecting hypodermic needle in his vein is a bad idea. But it's cool, though.
It's an interesting thing because you could run out, or, your mm-hmm. little timer could run out.
Right, you always want... You know, whether it's kryptonite or you always want some kind of a weakness, and that would be definitely an easy one for...
Yeah, plus he became addicted. He was going through withdrawal symptoms just like a drug addict.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And his son, I think, had the same powers if you read, like, the Infinity Incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
He was also addiction problems.
Yeah, that was... Because those were all... That took place in the modern time. They were all descendants, right?
Yeah.
When, like, the All-Star Squadron and stuff were still supposed to be taking place in the 40s.
Yeah. They actually released a hardcover of Infinity Incorporated recently. I actually bought it, so I might be digging into that.
That's cool. I think I actually just completed... I think I have all the issues now. Because I was working on that one because I like that, all that Justice Society related stuff. That's one of the things I would say I sort of miss in the New 52 is families. I don't feel like there's a lot of, especially now that some of the heroes that used to have relationships are single and stuff like that. It's a lot of young characters, so there's not as much there aren't as many families
or legacy.
Legacies, yeah. That, those two things kind of go together. That would be... I don't have a problem with the New 52 or anything, just that... And I get where they're, you know, going with that, but that was one of the things, unfortunately, that I... that appealed to me about DC, was all the families and legacies and stuff.
Yeah. But. Yeah, I don't know why they feel like writers can't write married couples or anything. It doesn't seem like there's too many around anymore. It's like Mr. and Mrs. Fantastic, and I think that's it. I can't even name them all.
Well, the only one really in that made it through the New 52 is, I think, was Aquaman and Mira.
Yeah. But even they had their problems early on. She was trying to kill him.
Yeah. That's always a downer.
Yeah. Their relationship has grown, though. I mean, I don't know if you're still reading it, but it's some pretty good dialogue there from Mara in the last issue.
Yeah, I've read up to 13. I like it. I like... Well, one of the appeals of that has been the art. But I like Mira a lot as a character.
Yeah, she's pretty cool.
So, well, one thing I was going to mention real quick, I think I sent you a link to this, but it might be interesting to anyone that Tomorrow's Publishing has a sale going on. They're not sponsoring this message or anything.
That'd be nice.
Although they're more than welcome to sponsor us. But they got a sale going on that it's not a lot of stuff on sale, but what is on sale is super cheap. And I just got, what made me think of it is Friday, my package came. And I think there's like, they're not all books, but there's about 17 items on it. It's going on till November 30th, so people should still have time when they hear this. But I got, I think, I got 5 books, and it was, like, a little bit under $30 for the whole, for all of them.
What'd you pick up?
I ended up getting the book on Carmine Infantino.
Oh, nice.
I think that was, like, $7 or $8. And I got the Blue Beetle Companion, which was $5. And that just kind of, it goes through the whole history of all the different characters that have been called Blue Beetle.
Yeah, I bought that one.
Yeah, it's pretty... I bought Teen Titans Companion Volume 2. That was like $6 or $7. That covers... Unfortunately, I don't have the first volume, and I think it's out of print, but that covers, you know, like the Geoff Johns Teen Titans and the incarnation right before that, and has lots of interviews about the different characters and stuff and the design and the approach behind them.
Does it have the Dan Jurgens Teen Titans?
I think it was like the early 2000s.
Yeah, the ones that all got annihilated in Infinite Crisis.
Yeah, it basically covers the Titans stuff. Infinite Crisis. Stuff like that, because it goes... I think there's also some chapters on those. I forget the name of this little story, but that dealt with Teen Titans and Young Justice, where they mixed up the two teams, and Young Justice got canceled. And but yeah, some stuff about that in there. And I got... the other two I got were the Alter Ego... it's basically the first, I think, 10 or 11 issues of Alter Ego, that came out way back in the day. And then I got Streetwise, which is all, that's less of a reference book and more of an actual comic book, because it's all, autobiographical and maybe some biographical stories by comic creators. One of the things I was interested in that was that it has the story by Kirby in it, which you probably have seen somewhere or seen elsewhere. But it's a little story by him, and it's it's neat because, I mean, I was just flipping through it. I haven't read it yet, but it's done in, it's just his pencils. And it's about him growing up when he was a little kid. And there's this really cool double page spread. It's a street scene with like tons of detail. It's neat to just be able to look at his pencils.
Yeah, I think I gotta pick this up. It's only $4.99. What the hell?
Yeah, there's a lot of other cool stuff in there too, in addition to his. But so yeah, there's some. I think there's some other stuff. I don't. There's like
ooh, the Thunder Agent's companion. Yeah. That one's got my attention. And the Sal Buscema.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my favorite artists, so I wouldn't mind picking that up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those two were ones I was thinking about. I was trying not to go too crazy, but I'm tempted to maybe do another order just because it's just, I mean, the prices, I'm throwing prices out there. These are, and these prices tend to be like around 70% off cover price, so that sounds appealing to anybody. It's worth checking out.
There's some good stuff there.
And if,
was there more there, and then they just sold out and they took them off, or what? Or was this pretty much the full list?
I think it's still the full list, yeah.
Mm.
So it wasn't a huge list, but
the one that I really want to get and I haven't got, maybe next year's con, is the Freedom Fighters one. I sure would like to get that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're really good, and if some reason, if anyone out there doesn't know, I know we've talked about Back Issue and Alter Ego magazines. Tomorrow's is the company that puts those out, as well as Jack Kirby Collector and a few other magazines, and they do a lot of books. Good reference for people that like old comics. Good reads.
Yeah. It's good articles.
Yeah. So
a lot of history there. Mm-hmm. And they managed to get their hands on like things that has never seen print. You know,
yeah.
Like pages and unpublished work and stuff like that. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's one of the things I like too. Yeah, a lot. You know, they'll have original artwork or, you know, the actual comic book page. You know, you can still see the margins and stuff. So yeah, they usually have some good stuff to look at. So.
Do you want to talk some comics? What did you discover this week?
Sure. Well, speaking of Roy Thomas in the 40s, and I did check out some Invaders.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I went in and I read these on the Marvel Digital Unlimited. And I actually ended up reading them slightly out of order because, yeah, I just browsed by first, you know, comic title. So I went to I for Invaders. And I'm reading Invaders number one. I kept coming across editor's notes referencing back to issue number one. I'm like, I'm reading number one. What the hell? but then I got to the end and there was a special note about how it was the 25-cent issue, and the second half was going to be in Invaders number 2 instead of a double-size 50-cent. And I was like, oh, you know, that made me realize that must have been a giant size.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, so I went, that was actually the first issue was giant size Invaders number 1. So, fortunately, that was on there, too. So I went back and read that after Invaders number 1. These came out in the 70s. Like I said, they were written by Roy Thomas. I read Giant Size Invaders number 1, Invaders 1, Invaders 2, and they're all written by Roy Thomas, penciled by Frank Robbins, and inks by the guy that is inking Kirby on the Fourth World stuff, Vince Coletta.
That guy was popular.
Yeah, he did a lot of work back then. So these take place in the 1940s. The team is Captain America and Bucky, Namor, and the original Human Torch, the android version, and his sidekick Toro. And these are basically all the the superhero characters that actually were published during the 40s when Marvel Comics was timely comics. And I found out they're basically based on a similar team called the All-Winner Squad that was actually done in Timely by Timely back then. And so, yeah, these take place during World War II. And I like that the giant size was dedicated to Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and but I had dedication to Lee, Simon, and Kirby. So that's kind of cool. But basically, it starts. The first issue was all right. They spent several pages recapping Captain America's origin. So I sort of skimmed those because I've read that so many different times.
Was it reprinted origin or was it new material origin?
It was the same origin, but it was
redrawn and re-presented. Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't just
flashbacks from cut and paste.
Right. Yeah, but that was pretty much. They pretty much spent the first few pages on that, and then the war is going on. And this takes place around the time that America is getting involved in the war. And Cap and Bucky meet up again with the Human Torch and Toro. And there's a little editor's note at the bottom that says the last time they met up was in Young Allies number 1 in 1941. So it's picking up right from there. And this is where they come up against the Masterman, who's basically the Nazi version of Captain America. They're the Nazis are literally trying to replicate the Captain America formula.
Do you have a cape or no?
I don't think so. No, okay. He has a big swastika on his chest.
How about shoulder pads?
I think so, yeah. I don't have the comic open, but you there?
Yeah, I just lost you for 2 seconds.
Yeah.
That's weird. I haven't seen that creep its ugly head in a while.
Yeah, I think the last time was towards the end of the first episode we did.
Yeah.
But, yeah, basically they end up meeting up with Namor because he's helping to protect these ships. And Winston Churchill is on the ships because he's coming over to talk to FDR, I guess. And he's the one that gives them the name the Invaders. So I like that Invaders number 1 starts off with the five of them on a mission. And they're arguing over the name that Churchill gave them. They don't. Like, none of them really like the name Invaders, and they're suggesting different names. And, no surprise here, like, Namor is pretty much an asshole to everybody. But,
I think he always has been.
yeah.
Which is good, at least he's consistent.
Yeah. Sometimes it could be irritating, but it was done in a funny way. He was really sarcastic and making fun of Bucky and Toro, the younger team members.
Yeah, I like him. I find him very entertaining.
Yeah,
especially in the newer books. Like I liked him during the recent X-Men event.
Okay.
The Hope. It was pretty cool to see him, because they even had scenes where he met up with Cap, like, and they're on opposing sides, but they still have that Invaders, you know. All Winners Squad legacy, so even though they're fighting, they're willing to sit at the table and talk, you know? They still have mutual respect for each other.
So Namor is on the side of the X-Men, then?
Yeah, he is an X-Men. He's the first mutant.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know vaguely what's going on in the Marvel Universe, but not really. But yeah, they end up running into this woman that's dressed like a Valkyrie. She's going by the name Hilda. She has amnesia, and she has this funny-looking ring that has an atomic energy symbol on it. And so they decide to take her in and try to figure out what's going on with her. And they end up running into three guys that are posing or acting like claiming to be German gods, like German mythology. So they, in issue two, they decide to leave. Well, they end up leaving Bucky behind, which I thought was funny. And they head to Germany, and while the rest of the team fight those guys saying that they're German gods, they Cap goes with Hilda, and they run into a cave to hide. And Cap starts putting the moves on, and just as they're about to start making out, a bunch of Nazis that were in the cave start clapping and interrupt Cap's sexy time. So
he always has trouble having sexy time.
Yeah, even back in the 40s.
Yeah.
So I liked issue two the most because this is the one where things really got kind of crazy. It turns out that in the previous issues they'd been hearing about something called brain drain. They didn't really know what it was. And it turns out to be a former Nazi, a guy named Werner Schmidt. And he's going by the name Brain Drain. He says he's also, that's his nickname, but he's, he technically is Operative A-1416. And what he is basically a robot with a floating brain for a head. But I like that he still has his eyes and the optic. So it's not like Krang from the Ninja Turtles or something where the eyes are in the brain itself. He still has his optic nerves. And it's like it's all floating in a helmet on top of his head. And it turns out that he was turned into this being or turned into Brain Drain by what he thought was a meteorite. It was actually the ship of Hilda and these other guys that are posing as German gods. And the ring that they found that had the atomic symbol on it is actually the power device for their ship. And Brain Drain was using it to... he basically abducted Hilda, and he was trying to... What's funny to me is that he's trying to get Hilda to love him, even though he's a floating brain above a robot body. So it turns out that Hilda's actually an alien. She says her name is MCM-XLI, and she's the navigator of the Nebula cruiser, the Kelly Lee. And the ring ends up causing an atomic explosion, and the invaders escape just in time. But MCM-XLI, to me, will definitely look like Roman numerals, so I figured out what it was, and it's 1941, or 1941, the time that the comic took place, so I thought that was kind of neat.
Yeah, I think Roy Thomas knew a lot about that time period, because he seemed to focus a lot on it.
Yeah, this is very... Before I even... I kind of remembered that Roy Thomas had written some Invader stuff, but before I even confirmed it, I was figuring that it would be him.
Yeah, he's All-Star Squadron. Huge run.
Yeah, and this being the 70s, this would be kind of not that long before he ended up going to DC and creating the All-Star Squadron, which also took place during the same time period. So, but yeah, it was pretty fine. I think this ran for 20-something issues. I'll probably read some more at some point. Like I said, I liked issue two the most because it got, I liked how when it got into the weirdness of combining the World War II environment with the weird sci-fi and all of that. So That was pretty cool.
Was it an, like, did it hold up as far as entertainment value, like, or was it kind of hard to push through, or?
Not so much issue two. Giant size invaders, a little bit, because like I said, the cat fortune went on a bit, and I find that, for me, Roy Thomas stuff holds up because of the subject matter. It does, his stuff from the 70s and 80s can feel a little bit dated in terms of the style of writing, but I tend to still like his stuff because of the characters that, because he works with such obscure characters, and he has that sort of classic superhero feel to it.
What did the cover to the giant size look like?
Let me bring it up if I can.
Because all I see is like a king size annual. I was wondering if it really is a giant size or.
Yeah, it was. It has the team on it, running towards you.
Huh.
And they're running across the globe with a Nazi symbol, Fortress Europa, it says, and they're being fired at from machine gun. The machine gun fires hitting Captain America's shield and reflecting off.
Yeah, that's not the one that I'm seeing. I'll have to go look for that.
Yeah, it's 50 cent issue, 68 big pages, it says.
Huh.
So I guess, and they were originally going to do Giant Size Invaders number 2, and then I guess across the board, Marvel wanted to stop doing the larger issues, so that's why they already had it ready to go. I guess that's why they didn't even have time to change the editor's notes in Invaders number 1.
Yeah. Or,
you know, because I think they pretty much had issues 1 and 2 ready to go, and then they ended up splitting it up into 2 25 cent issues. So, but yeah, I know that was something that I think a listener was interested hearing us talk about, and I liked going back and checking it out. I haven't read a lot of Bronze Age Marvel stuff.
Yeah, I only own one Invaders comic. It's number 34. And if I was to go find it, it would be really hell. I mean, it would just be underneath. That was before the drawer box. So they're stacked. Yeah. I always like the covers, though. Mm-hmm. The covers of the Invaders are great. And I like the characters, but mostly I know them from, like, Avengers West Coast, or, like, that's where the Human Torch showed up, and he was in Heroes for Hire for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. Didn't read too much Invaders. I read the 1993 Invaders. It was a 4-issue miniseries. And then there was Avengers versus the Invaders or something like that that Alex Ross was doing. And I started reading that but didn't finish it.
Mm. Yeah, I wonder if they'll have, since they recently did Defenders and they're going to have Fearless Defenders, I wonder if we'll see Invaders again sometime.
That Valkyrie wasn't the Valkyrie in the Defenders, though, was she? Was it?
No, I almost thought, because her first appearance is a splash page, and it, you know, she's got the blonde hair, and she looked similar enough that I thought maybe that was, at first I thought that that's what was going to be the case, but I think she's just this supposed to be, because they were, I think Brain Drain basically being German and stuff, he was kind of behind them posing as German gods from German mythology.
Mm-hmm.
So I think she just basically was this alien named 1941. So I don't think these characters, I know Brain Drain had another appearance later on, I guess, in an Alpha Flight issue of all places. But I don't think these other Hilda and these other guys did.
Yeah, they haven't had too much of a successful runs. I mean, that was the one you're reading now is their most successful incarnation. It ran from 1975 all the way to 1977 or 1979. So that was a decent run, I guess.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure All-Star Squadron started in what, 81 or 82.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like when he left.
Yeah. And that was during that time period, I think, was when he was one of many editors in chief. Because I know Marvel went through a ton of different people between Stan Lee and Jim Shooter. There was a ton of different editors in chief.
I think he did that comic, The Young All-Stars, too. I'm not sure. Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he did.
That was Ian Monroe, the Flying Fox, and all those other characters.
Yeah, I've read that that title was basically his consolation for the fact that Crisis destroyed his books, basically. Because the All-Star Squadron got canceled, and so did Infinity Inc. eventually, and those characters didn't really have a place. They were Earth 2 books, so there was no more Earth 2, and, you know, the JSA would come back, but right at that time, they didn't, and I think they gave him, he came up with Young All-Stars and based a lot of the characters, I think, were analogs for other characters, but he, like he usually did,
made them younger, yeah.
Yeah, and pulled them out of, I think some of them at least were obscure Golden Age characters that he based them on, because he liked to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, he had Neptune Perkins and Flying Fox and I think Tsunami,
mm-hmm.
Dynamite, TNT and Dynamite, I think. And then the female Fury, that Golden Fury chick,
yeah.
She started appearing in Wonder Woman in the 90s, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny that, like I said, the books that Roy Thomas was writing around the time of Crisis were really affected by Crisis, but All-Star Squadron had a whole lot of tie-ins to the Crisis, so at least he was trying to be a team player, it seemed like. But
yeah, he was also responsible for Infinity Inc., so you know, he ran with it.
Yeah, Infinity Inc. too also had several tie-ins, because wasn't that robot that was in Oscar?
Stars and Stripe, or which one?
The robot that was in All-Star Squadron that was tied into Crisis, Mechanique, I think her name was.
Oh, okay.
Like a female robot, and she was sort of, there was a brief period of time before the single Earth that was created by the Crisis event, before everybody totally forgot the old continuity, the characters, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Speaking of Crisis, I think I had one of the geekiest dreams I've ever had, that I was explaining in really in-depth, like, information to somebody in the dream about, you know, the various crises that DC has had and how they're connected, and I woke up and I'm like, oh my god, what is wrong? Oh man.
Oh, we might be heading back to it with Grant Morrison's Multiversity. So,
Yeah, I'm curious as to how much that'll tie in to the regular DC universe.
Mm-hmm. Are you reading Earth 2 just out of curiosity?
Yeah, I have been, yeah.
Yeah. Because that's pretty interesting the way they're doing that.
Yeah. If I read it like it's an Elseworlds title, I think I enjoy it the most. You know?
Well, I'm reading the whole 52 like it's an Elseworlds title.
Yeah. Yeah, basically. I guess if I go to it looking for a JSA feel from it, I don't quite get that. But
yeah, but they're not even really a team yet.
No, it's definitely...
And Solomon Grundy is so different.
Mm-hmm.
He's almost like a Swamp Thing-ish. Because he taps into the gray.
Yeah, I think it's well written, the art. I definitely like Nicola Scott's art.
Yeah.
So it's quality. It's quality. It's just... If I went into it wanting to get what I would normally expect to get from reading about Jay Garrick or Alan Scott, you know, those characters, that expectation's not going to be met. Because mm-hmm. There's some core similarities, but, you know, I'm used to getting a certain thing from reading about Jay Garrick that I'm not going to get from there, you know?
Yeah.
So as long as I go into it with the right mindset, I think it's a quality comic.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. It's definitely not JSA enjoyment, but
no,
I'm enjoying it for different reasons, I guess.
Yeah.
So yeah. I had one. I got Superman's Girlfriend Lois Lane number 134.
Ah.
And it's from 1973. It's written by Kerry Bates, who's one of my all-time favorites, with art by John Roth Rosenberger and Vince Coletta. Seems to be, like, all over the place.
I think he inked everything in the Bronze Age.
Yeah. I think Marvel and DC just hired him to ink.
Mm-hmm.
Just ink this. But this story takes place... The way Lois Lane's stories are always kind of told is... They usually have a panel up front that takes you to the midpoint of the story. Like, why is Lois carrying, you know, Kandor? And why is she flying? It, like, introduces you, like, she's stealing Kandor and she's got superpowers. And then it flashes back and tells you how she got those powers. But it's essentially Superman taking Lois on a date into his Fortress of Solitude, showing her around. Letting her go about her own business while he checks his alarms and stuff, and she finds Kandor, and a little laser beam shoots out of Kandor and hits her in the head. And you think that, oh, wow, she's turning evil or whatever, and turns out she's not turning evil, but somebody actually teleported their mind or switched places with her, and she got stuck in Kandor while somebody that looks exactly like her is out on, she's a Kryptonian out doing supervillain stuff. And it's weird because in Kandor they have somebody that looks exactly like Superman, somebody that looks like exactly like Jimmy Olsen, and I mean they're like clones, but they're Kryptonians, so I don't know how that ever happened. So it was kind of ridiculous, but turns out that two villains escape from Kandor, and Superman and Lois get stuck in microscopic size in Kandor and replace them. And they eventually escape with a retro rifle. How about that?
Oh, what does the retro rifle do?
It allows them to fly and blast out just about anything. But they eventually do like a trick on the other two people, the two villains, and swap back and shrink them back to size, and they swap back in place. Nice. And everything's all good and happy. The thing that was really interesting was the text in this comic, I guess like three quarters of the way, It has a behind the scenes at DC's Comic World, and in this particular issue, this is like when the Metropolis, Illinois, you know, Superman world town is opening up. As far as like their tribute to Superman, this is like the first year, and it tells you like what the museum's gonna have in it and what admission is, like $1.75 per adult, $1.25 per child. And it's pretty interesting. It's like a museum of comics and all kinds of historical stuff and how comics are created and stuff like that in Sparta, right. Illinois, and how they had a print plant there. And it's pretty interesting. I found that really interesting. Also, at this time, it says that Walt Simonson's going to start doing a backup in Detective Comics. And he was doing art and sword and sorcery, so, you know, he's a big name.
Yeah.
And then the Spectre was joining Adventure Comics. So, yeah, so I like the history stuff that's happening in this. And some of the letters I read. It's interesting that a book like Superman's Girlfriend, Lois Lane, most of the letters are all of the letters are from dudes. So, like, if they were trying to appeal to the female, I don't ever see female letters in here. But the first one was interesting because he was complaining about the second story. At this time, I guess the first feature was Lois Lane. The backup feature was Rose, you know, Thorn and Rose. And he said that he hated the second story because it was going too much into women's liberation. So that was kind of crazy. And a lot of people complaining. So it's just like, you know, the complaints have always been there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're saying, well, you know, how come... We already know this. Every issue is about Lois trying to hook up with Superman. Well, why don't you ever think about Lois hooking up with Clark and him revealing his identity? And they're saying, we've already done that. So it's just a bunch of people complaining that nothing ever changes. You know, the status quo stays the same.
Yeah. Which was a valid criticism of DC in the 70s, as I understand.
And there was a lot of ads in here about changing your career, which is pretty interesting. It's like some guy yelling at his boss. He shows up late for work and he says, well, I'm going to get a better job doing electronics because I sent away for this. And how to become a locksmith.
Well, there you go.
You could send away for your locksmith kit.
Come Mr. Miracle.
Earn a better living. So that was a pretty interesting comic. I liked it.
Yeah, that's one thing you never know when you pick up an old comic book, what other stuff you're going to find in there besides what you're expecting to read.
Yeah.
The old ads, and even like you said, that piece about, what was it called, Superman World?
Or yeah. Whatever.
Yeah, in Illinois. It's just, you know, that text piece may not be reprinted anywhere, you know?
Yep.
It's kind of neat. I think it's funny how, if I was Superman in the 70s, I don't think I would talk to anybody. Like, all his friends just caused trouble for his life. The supporting cast is a pain in the
In this case, ass. I don't think Lois caused problems, though. It just, she just happened to, she was writing some Daily Planet articles and happened to run across Kandor, and two villains happened to escape. One mm-hmm. was a psycho, and the other one was a really evil woman. Mm-hmm. But everything was restored back to normal. They got him back into Kandor in a jail cell. So I just don't understand. The one thing that was never explained is why there were Kryptonians in Kandor that looked exactly like Lois and Superman and Perry White and Jimmy Olsen and Cat Grant. You know, like, why were they there? So it's like when they swapped bodies, nobody noticed. In other words, they thought it was Lois because they look exactly alike.
Yeah, it's quite didn't a have coincidence.
To explain it. Yeah, didn't have to explain it.
I think we should probably get one of those retro guns for the podcast.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome, the retro gun.
It would be neat if you could fire it at somebody and turn them into a like a 70s version of themselves. We went and saw that movie Argo.
Oh yeah.
And that takes place in the 70s, and they did a pretty good job with the fashions and stuff. Like everyone's glasses were humongous.
Yeah.
Like, thank God for contact lenses. Holy crap.
Contacts in high school and some of college, and then I just said fuck it, because I always had like an uncomfortable feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Like I could always tell they were there. I could never like not tell they were there.
Yeah, everybody's eyes are different. Mine tolerate them pretty well. The first time I tried them when I was like 13 or 14, I just couldn't deal with it. Putting them in, I just couldn't get used to it. But the second time I tried them, it went better.
Yeah.
But
now they
have some people
to make it better, and I still don't want to do that.
Yeah, Kara did it. Her eyes are. She doesn't have to wear anything anymore.
She likes it.
Yeah, it worked out good for her. But. If I'd be a lot more pressed to think about it if, like I said, I put them in the morning, I have them in almost all day, and I never really have any problems. So if they were more irritating to me or I didn't want to wear glasses, then maybe I would think about it. But
do you have any other comics you wanted to mention?
Yeah, I got a couple probably quick ones. I read a couple number ones. I randomly read Doom Patrol number one, the 80s Doom Patrol. It's free on Comixology right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm always checking. I'm all about the free comics on Comixology, so I'm always checking whenever they update stuff on Wednesdays. I always check to see what new free comics were put on there and give them a miss that time.
Yeah, was that the Paul Cooperberg? Or
Doom Patrol number one. So this is the one that ended up being the Grant Morrison one later on, but this is Paul Cooperberg, Steve Lytle, and Gary Martin inks, and it was pretty good. The first few pages are a recap of stuff that's happened. Even though it's number one, it kind of catches you. It continues the Doom Patrol story from previous series and stuff. So the first few pages are recap of what's gone on in the past. And you have, this is the Celsius, who is the wife of the chief. You know, the Doom Patrol are all believed to be dead, but she thinks that her husband, the chief, is still alive.
She looked a little young for him.
Yeah. Yeah, because he's depicted kind of as an older man. 50s, maybe 60s.
Yeah. Kind of like Professor X.
Yeah. It's weird that you say that, because one of the things I read was talking about comparisons between X-Men and Doom Patrol, the original Doom Patrols, like in the 60s, and people speculate whether, you know, one copied the other or not, and they came out kind of too close. But then some people say that Stan Lee may have had prior knowledge of the Doom Patrol, which might have given him enough time to create the X-Men, but who knows? It's one of those things no one will ever know for sure. But, the original Doom Patrol, if I got this right, was the Chief, Robot Man, Elastigirl, and Negative Man.
Yeah.
So they're, the only one that is known to be alive for sure is Robot Man, Cliff Steele. So Celsius wants his help to find the Chief, and he at first is not happy to see her at all.
Did they mention Tempest at all, or some guy
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, Tempest.
Because that was in the previous, like, showcase where he, I think he died or something.
No, he, after Celsius convinced Robot Man to help her find the Chief, he goes to see Tempest, who's working as a doctor using somebody else's credentials.
Oh.
So, Robot Man, like, I mean, none of these, one of the things about the Doom Patrol is that they don't, the team tends not to get along very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do a lot of arguing, but eventually Robot Man convinces Tempest to help, and they're looking for so they're looking when the initial Doom Patrol team supposed to have died, this happened in Maine. So Robot Man is searching the water near where they died and trying to find the Chief's body or anything. He ends up actually finding the body of Elastigirl and comes out of the water, and he's mourning his old friend and stuff like that. And Celsius doesn't have any sympathy for him all. She's just like, tells him, Elastigirl's dead. We need to focus on the living. The Chief might be alive. That's the matter at hand. He's just like, and Tempest yells at her for being so heartless and not having more sympathy. And all in all, they don't get along very good, and that's pretty much the issue, but it was pretty cool. I know of the Doom Patrol, but I haven't read a lot of Doom Patrol, and I like the quirkiness of the team.
And Eric Larson showed up in issue 6 as the artist.
Yeah, I think wasn't that like one of the first things he did?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right before Morrison.
Yep. And then Morrison.
Morrison took the whole team in a very different direction.
Yeah, he went pretty crazy with it.
And it was a while before it really became a Vertigo book, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it became really weird. It was still in the DCU. Like, yeah, issue 29, you'll see Superman and the Flash in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's one of those books. Same thing with Grant Morrison's Animal Man. It retroactively got labeled Vertigo. Like, the trades, the Animal Man trades say Vertigo on them, but they didn't.
They weren't really Vertigo for quite some time.
Yeah, because there's actually, like, they were involved, like, there's an Animal Man issue that's involved in the Invasion crossover and stuff, which later on, Vertigo books wouldn't do that.
So interesting enough, Doom Patrol wasn't even a Vertigo book until Grant Morrison left.
Yeah.
And issue 64, Rachel Pollack took over, and that's when it became a Vertigo title.
Mm-hmm. But if you get the Doom Patrol trades now of Morrison's run, they say Vertigo on them.
Yeah. Just
like the Animal Man ones, but
it felt like a Vertigo book.
Yeah.
Just the label maybe came later.
Yeah.
They like moved a lot into Vertigo, like Swamp Thing and Black Orchid and all kinds of stuff. Hellblazer.
Yeah.
Now they're moving it back.
Man, people were not happy to hear Hellblazer is getting canceled.
Yeah. But I can see from a business perspective, because they're only pushing like 9,000 copies they're selling. So
yeah.
Even though it's like a consistent seller, do you know what I mean? It's like a flat line. So it's like everybody that's buying, it's buying it.
Yeah.
So if they can double the sales, and he's already in the DCU proper,
right?
They've achieved what they set to achieve. They probably piss off the 10,000 fans that are reading it, but
right. But I wouldn't be surprised if they get 25,000 new people to try it.
They'll get new people to try it, and then half of the old Hellblazer, just because of what you like the character so much, will probably follow him. And then there's a small percentage that will say, or half the percentage will say, screw it, I don't want to read the clean Hellblazer, I want the Vertigo Hellblazer.
Yeah.
So.
And one of the things I thought when I saw it was just, when was the last time a Vertigo series made it to 300?
Right. Well, any title. Hellblazer was the only title that DC had that had a triple digit.
Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't happen too often in comics anymore.
Yeah. So I have one more. I wanted to finish this before we started podcasting, but I didn't get to finish it. But I read Blood Pack number 2 and 3. I had read number 1 a long, long time ago.
Oh, okay.
And this is the team that came out of Bloodlines. And
oh, right. Okay.
It was a fairly interesting... Like, I read issue 2 and I was kind of lost. I mean, I really didn't know what the hell was going on. But as soon as I read issue 3, I got the gist of what was going on. But this was by Charles Moore, who I've never heard of. Mm-mm. And Chris Taylor on pencils. And Andy Lanning is the inker. I've heard of the inker, and I've heard of Chris Eliopoulos. Like, he's a big letterer, and he's done his own thing at Image.
Yeah.
And he's done, like, what is it, Franklin Richards books at Marvel. And this had Eddie Braganza. I didn't realize how long Eddie Braganza's been around, but this is from 1995. And it's a reality-based TV team, TV show that they're trying to actually get picked up, you know, like by a network. And it's following Jade, who we know from Infinity Inc., who's also the daughter of Alan Scott. She's kind of like their promoter. She's trying to make the show happen. And there's a director behind all this. And then there's Ballistic. He's a Korean superhero, invulnerable armor, and he carries around a lot of guns. All of these guys were bit by those aliens in the Bloodlines. And I read a lot of the annuals, but I want to pick up all of them. I want to understand how they got their powers, where they came from. I think I own about half of the annuals, so a lot of these characters I know about. Nightblade was a Chinese-American with the ability to regenerate his entire body. He's like a Wolverine, but he always throws, like, blades. Loria is a super-strong metal-skinned person. Geist is a ghost-like night hero. He could, like, turn invisible. And I think he's got ghost abilities, so he can, like, phase through things. He's a lot like... he's redundant, actually, with another character that got created during that time, Argus, which I already talked about. Mongrel is a African-American Vietnamese that can blast shadow forces. Sparks is a person that can control lightning. And Razor Sharp, she's got blades as arms. And the interesting thing about all these characters is in Infinite Crisis number 7, they killed almost all of them. Ballistic died in Infinite Crisis number 7. Nightblade died in... I don't know how he could have died because he can regenerate, but they say he died in Infinite Crisis number 7. Geist died in Infinite Crisis number 7. Mongrel died in Infinite Crisis number 7. And Razor Sharp died. So that's almost the whole team, minus Sparks. And Sparks has appeared in, like, the animated series, and I think she was in the Superboy and the Reavers or whatever that series was.
Oh, okay.
And so it's an interesting bunch of characters trying to make their way. And it's weird because there's this organization called the Producers, and they don't know, they've never seen their bosses, but they seem to be like an alien race that's using them to import and export alien technology on Earth. And it's very interesting from that perspective. And it involves the Dark Stars, which I don't know if you remember the Dark Stars, but they were like the Green Lantern Corps replacement back in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
When there was only one ring and Kyle Rayner had it.
Mm-hmm.
The Space Cops, the Dark Stars, showed up. But there's a lot of conspiracy and craziness going on in here, and I wanted to find out what happened in issue 4, but I'll probably read it after the show because I'm real curious. I found I really didn't like issue 2, but like you and the Invaders, I read the next one, and I really got hooked into the story. So
yeah. How long did that last?
It was a 4-issue mini, so once I'm I'm done.
Yeah.
And they lost one of their members in issue one, I think. Lorna, she was the metal one. She died. And then in number two, they actually teamed up with Superboy and tried to get him to join. And they have all these, like, if you're familiar with Booster Gold, they have these cameras that are actually following them around all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they have these editors that, like, they'll get their asses kicked. They fought the Demolition Team, which is a weird team of that wore yellow. They were like Green Lantern villains that wore like yellow and had construction suits. They got their like asses handed to them and had to have another group bail them out. But when the TV editors got it, they like made them look like they were awesome. And
sounds like reality TV.
Yeah, Alan Scott is still a TV producer, so Jade is trying to get him to pick up the show. And he questions her, I guess he questions her trust and stuff, because she's like, you haven't even met the show producers yet? What's wrong with you? But it was a lot of fun. The art was good. It actually had the Titans appear in here in issue 3. And at that time, the Titans were run by Arsenal, and Supergirl was part of the Titans, and Impulse.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just interesting seeing the history of the book.
Yeah. I had no idea Jade was involved in that.
Yeah, Jade was involved.
I don't know what it is about green-skinned women, but...
She was hot.
Yeah, I miss Jade.
Yeah, she was with Kyle for a while.
Yeah.
Kyle was banging a lot of superheroes, I tell you that. He had Jade and Donna Troy, and I think there was one other. So he was the stud dude.
Yeah. I guess it helps to be the only Green Lantern.
Yeah. So. And then just point out a fact, a new blood pack was introduced in Faces of Evil Prometheus, which was also like an annual based storyline. And this one was interesting enough. It was led by Argus, which is the guy I just finished reading. Gunfire, who had his own series for a while. Anima, who had her series. And Hook. So, you know, a lot of people complain about new creations in comics, but a lot of these creations were created and none of them really took. I think the only one that really took was Sparks, because she at least appeared in the animated series, and Jade, which was already established. And I don't think any of these characters exist in the New 52, with the exception of they did introduce Loose Cannon, who was like a Hulk-type power guy that wasn't part of the Blood Pack but was bitten by the alien. But it's interesting looking at this list of characters. None of them really made it very big.
Yeah, they all just like...
They've all had comics of their own, you know? Like Anima had hers, Gunfire had his, Hitman, Loose Cannon had a comic. So they were... They all, and then Razor Sharp, who had those arms as a... that turned to razors. She was also a computer hacker. She was part of the Cybat series that John Byrne did. So,
sounds like they're creating characters to try to appeal to people that were buying Image books at the time.
Yeah, and a lot of them are diverse characters. In other words, have an ethnicity to them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably the best thing about it.
Yeah. But I really started reading two, and I was like, I don't like this at all. Should I even continue?
Yeah.
And sure enough, I read, once I figured out what was going on again, and then got into issue 3, I got hooked. So I'm looking forward to reading issue 4.
Yeah, I think Jeff Johns was writing Infinite Crisis and was looking for cannon fodder, and he remembered the 90s. I think that's probably the only time I've ever seen those characters is in Infinite Crisis.
Yeah, I find it interesting that they gave them series, you know what I mean? Instead of just launching one or two, they launched quite a bit of them into their own series, and none of them took, except for Hitman. He was the only one
that
had a long run. It's kind of like Jack Kirby stuff. Nobody really hit except for Commandy.
It seems to happen a lot of times. You create, like, it's almost like you throw a whole bunch of characters at the wall and see which one sticks.
Yeah.
So you'll create 20 characters and two of them will catch on or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same way with Milestone, you know?
Yeah, that's something I would like to dive into at some point. I find this very... I love this podcast because I'm actually reading stuff that I wouldn't normally read. I have. I just wouldn't read because of the sheer quantity of monthlies I get. Well, I'm falling behind in that too, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I find myself going... This. Yeah, like thinking, what would be different to read? What would... You know? Like the one other thing I was going to mention real quick is I read... And I've had this for a year, I think. Dreadstar number one.
Oh, I've never read that.
The Jim Starlin. And this was a... This had even more of a recap issue with it. Like I said about Doom Patrol, even though it was a number one, this was the first comic ever published under... Well, the first new series ever published under the Epic Comics imprint, which is the... imprint that Jim Shooter created for creator-owned comics at Marvel. And this continued, eventually moved over when Epic, I guess it must have been when Epic Comics went away. It continued at First Comics. But even though this is the first issue, it recaps a bunch of stuff from Epic Illustrated, which is their anthology, and there was a Marvel graphic novel of Dreadstar. And it actually takes up the first 11 pages of the comic is recaps and stuff, and I was interested, but it was a weird way. It didn't really grab you. It was because not only were there 11 pages, they're really packed.
Yeah, really dense.
Yeah, but I mean, I got through it because it is cool, the world that he created. It's a sci-fi kind of environment, and then really quickly, just, you know, the second half of the... I won't really go into all the recapping and stuff, but really quickly, the basic setup is that there's two warring powers. One's the monarchy, and one's the instrumentality. And the instrumentality is kind of like a religious zealot, or like religious zealots. And basically, Dreadstar and his group, they're kind of like the Starjammers or something. They're trying to end the war, and in doing so, they team up with the monarchy a little bit. It's kind of like a lesser of two evils. And I have to get through the recap of everything that happened prior to this number one. The second half of the issue is about them invading. So the instrumentality, they have these treasury satellites, which I thought was a cool idea. Each one of the satellites holds a tenth of their wealth. So they show up and they're going to invade the satellite to get funds for their mission. And they're prepared for the satellite defenses and everything, but as they're starting to unload some of the riches and stuff, a huge destroyer ship shows up. And that's when they find out that the instrumentality has precision teleportation technology. So then they have a little bit more of a battle on their hands, basically. But that's, I guess, that the instrumentality had been getting an upper hand in the war. So, and it was thanks to this teleportation technology that they have. So at the end of the issue, they talk about how they need to get a hold of that technology if they're going to be able to do anything. And they are successful in getting some money, so they talk about how that's going to allow them to start working on this operation they have that's called Plan M. And it's just left to be a mystery what Plan M is, but they seems to be a big deal because they talk about how even though the monarchy has worked with them sometimes, it's going to piss off the monarchy too. So it was pretty neat. I have number two, and then I think I just have some other random issues out of sequence, but thought it'd be kind of cool to read something that was that fit the time period, but that wasn't that was creator owned.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting is it hopped publishers at issue 27. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It went on. And he later, I guess, allowed Peter David to do some writing. It's mostly all, like, this issue is all Jim Starlin. It's, is it Starlin or Starin? I always mix that up.
Starlin.
Okay. Because I used to live near a road called Starin. I used to call it Starlin. I had to explain to Kara that it was because there was a comic book creator named Jim Starlin. But it's all him. You know, he does the art and the writing and stuff. So
yeah, that went to Malibu when Peter David was doing it under the Bravado line, which I think was their creator-owned line.
Cool. Yeah, I'd like to explore in the future some more of this, more of the indie stuff that's not, you know, indie stuff from the 80s and stuff like that that's a little bit older.
Yeah.
Some of these publishers that aren't around anymore. But
cool.
Yeah.
I got one more thing. I read Contest of Champions number 2. So last time I talked about number 1.
Yeah.
And this one, you still have the Grandmaster, and in this one you have the Unknown. But it's Death. It's essentially Death. They're playing a game with all the superheroes in the Marvel Universe. And the first, they basically have to find these discs, these gold discs. Mm-hmm. And the first team is Daredevil, Darkstar, and Talisman, because they're introducing all these new different characters too. And then the second team is Sunfire, Invisible Woman, and Iron Fist. Very unusual teams, but they stick these guys in the North Pole, and they're supposed to fight each other, and whoever gets the piece wins. And the interesting thing about this is they can't work as a team. Neither team works as a team. They kind of go off on their own. Darkstar goes to the air. Sunfire says, screw this, I'm just going to go find it. He's the only one that has a power that could exist pretty well in the freezing cold and blizzard that they're in. Although I thought Sue Storm could probably like put an invisible force bubble around her. Mm-hmm. And I never really explored or read anywhere if the climate when she's inside of her own bubble absorbs the climate of the outside. So, and in this case, she's freezing to death. But they kind of all go their own ways, except Iron Fist and her introduce each other, and they said, okay, let's work as a team for the time being. Daredevil is a solo character, so he's like, how could I ditch this Talisman guy? He's kind of like, go find this. And Talisman is the same way. So Daredevil doesn't have to do the awkwardness. Talisman says, hey, go ahead and do what you're doing. Let me search for it my own way. Because he goes into like this dream time to look for it. So Talisman fights Invisible Woman. He detects her. He has a bull roar because he's from Australia. Uh-huh. And he takes her into this dreamscape where she loses her powers. Not really loses her powers, but gets disoriented. And Daredevil and Iron Fist start fighting. And obviously Darkstar and Sunfire are fighting in the air. So they're all doing these solo things while Daredevil ends up getting the piece with his billy club. He actually hooks it with his billy club. And so that's the Grandmaster's win. And then in the second fight, it's Arabian Knight, Iron Man, Sabra. It's interesting because you got, like, on that one team, which is the Unknown's team, which is Death's team, you have an Arab and an Israel, somebody from Israel, and you know how they hate each other. Mm-hmm. And they kind of even mentioned it in this, like they can't stand each other. And Iron Man's like, oh shit, how could I get anything done when these two guys hate each other? But then they got on the other team, Defensor, who's from Brazil, She-Hulk, and Captain Britain. And I think Defensor spends like half of his time trying to pick up on She-Hulk. and she just gets annoyed by it. But She-Hulk says they also do their solo thing. They're like, fuck this. She-Hulk jumps in the air and sees a Raymond Knight flaming on his carpet and like knocks the shit out of him and then starts fighting Sabra. And then Iron Man fights Defensor, and it looks like he's taking him out. And then Captain Britain's fighting Arabian Knight. So yeah, there's some cool throwdowns in here. And it turns out in this one, the Arabian Knight wins for for death. So it's tied. And in the next issue, we'll figure out who wins.
So, tiebreaker.
Yeah. I loved it when it came out. This is one that I got off the spinner rack. Mm. And I loved it when it came out at the time just because it had so many different heroes and you didn't usually see that. Like everybody. Yeah. And then it had a bunch of heroes that I've never seen before that were just created, and I've always liked that. And it was a lot of fun. I read it actually this morning, and I really enjoyed it. So I'm going to finish that series up next episode.
Cool. Yeah, I think that kind of, that whole appeal of having all those characters together, I think it's just continues into today with the crossovers and everything.
Right.
You know?
I just didn't... The only thing that's really weird about the series is why pick the heroes they picked if they can't even work as a team. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's such an odd band of heroes, and then why put the Israel character with the Arab character and cause all that controversy? If you're on the same team and you're trying to win, why would you do that?
Yeah. I mean, from a writer's perspective, obviously they wanted to create conflict, but then within the context of the story, it's like, doesn't really make sense, though.
Well, yeah, what really didn't make sense, though, is so far you've had two battles and nobody's working as a team. They're all individuals looking for the peace. Yeah.
Thankfully, it's 30 years later, the Israeli and Arab characters would get along really well.
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
Yeah, isn't there an incident going on right now?
Yeah, pretty
as
serious.
As we speak, yeah.
Yeah. So, that's cool.
Yeah, so it's interesting historically, and it's so much fun, and I think this is pre-Secret Wars, so...
Yeah.
It's like the first, big event, if you will, that wasn't... It was... There were events back in the day. They were just events within titles. Like, you'd have Avengers team and Defenders in their own titles. But it's the first time you had, like, a series coming out that was its own event.
Yeah, or, like, DC had the annual JLA-JSA crossovers.
Right.
And stuff like that. But, yeah, I think with that, it almost seems like they had the idea, let's do this mini series with all the heroes in it, and they came up with the setup. And then with Secret Wars, there's definitely some similarities. They learned to build up the plot a little bit more, the setup, even though it's still kind of creating a situation where you have heroes battling against each other in this other, outside of their normal habitat. They built up the story around the circumstances a little bit more.
Yeah.
So, should we shift gears?
Yeah, let's talk about our questions.
Yeah. Now, I didn't get any actual questions outside of the topics I suggested.
Oh, I didn't either, but you had some good topics.
Yeah, we don't need your questions. No. just kidding. Give us questions.
Yeah.
We can talk about some illegal toys.
Yeah.
I
got to the game late on this because I was trying to read so much of my current stuff that I didn't get around to this until, you know, late last night and a little bit this morning. And I was like, I wanted to research it more because I found it, like, absolutely fascinating, you know, just Googling and stuff, you know.
We could always do a follow-up.
Yeah, but this was a good topic. Did you want to kick one off and then I'll kick one off, or you want to alternate kind of thing? Or
yeah, that sounds good. I there are definitely some other, like you said, I found myself looking into and reading some other toys that I didn't play with that it was just interesting to me that they used to exist. But I basically, the notes I took down were about the main two that I thought of right away, and I just looked to find some more information about it. And the first one that I had was lawn darts.
that was one that I had too.
Did you? Okay.
Did you play with lawn darts?
Yep.
Yeah, so did I. It was like a family event a lot of times.
Yeah, the fact that I played with them is because I think that they were technically banned right around the time I was playing with them, or just before.
Yeah.
But my grandparents had them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we always played with them in a really safe fashion. We were all always, you know, we were allowed to play with them, but there was always adults involved or adults around.
Well, they kind of showed you how to play with them, right? They're like, this is what you're doing.
Yeah, we were careful, but apparently not everyone was. you know, because if you've never seen these are, you play with them basically like you play horseshoes, right? You know, you have a circle on the ground in a yard, you know, you play in a yard or something or dirt. And there are these basically huge darts, you know, I don't know, maybe a foot long or something. And they had sharp metal tips on the end, like a, you know, like darts that you throw at a dartboard, but bigger. And you grab it by the handle and you, you know, throw them underhand. You whip like you're going to throw a horseshoe or something. And it would sail through the air, and the object was to get it to impale itself in the earth inside of that circle. So, you know, I apologize in advance if I laugh while reading these. It's not funny, but the funny part of it to me is just that in hindsight, you know, as I'm describing it already, it sounds dangerous. Describe what these are, and it seems funny to me that you wouldn't automatically think this might not be a good idea. But I looked actually on there's the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which still exists today, and it's part of the government, and they review products and complaints and stuff like that. And I was actually able to find on their website, they have like all their old press releases and stuff. And it says, an estimated 3,200 people have been treated in hospital emergency rooms for injuries involving lawn darts from 1978 through 1986. At least 80% of the victims were younger than 15 years old, and more than 50% were 10 years old or younger. More than half of the victims had injuries to the head, eye, ear, or face. Investigations indicated that severe injuries included punctures, lacerations, and fractures to the head and skull. Although victims were often bystanders, in many cases those playing the game were children. So a lot of people really got hurt, and some people died.
Yeah, I found 4 deaths due to lawn darts.
And obviously it's not funny that children dying is obviously not funny at all. But to me, it's just insane to think. I could totally see how, you know, like I said, we were careful. We never, you know, had any issues, but...
But we also had parents that introduced us, or grandparents that introduced us to the game. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, horseshoes is just as dangerous if you throw a horseshoe at each other, right? I mean, you could clock somebody in the head with a horseshoe and...
That's true. They're heavy.
They're heavy. So... A lawn dart, I mean, the fact that it had a pointy, I mean, it, deathly pointy thing obviously could cause issues, but I don't know about you, but every time that the lawn darts were out, I was with the family. You know what I mean? It was like, let's play lawn darts.
Yeah.
So it never was a factor because you'd be playing it like horseshoes.
Right. Yeah, my grandparents were the ones that had the set, and we were always supervised when we played with them.
Yeah. But I guess if you're let your kids go and they find lawn darts and they don't know how to, it's a game, you could use it as a weapon, because playing war and stuff is fun as a kid, right? You play war with a lawn dart, somebody's going to get hurt.
And I think it says the victims were often bystanders. I think that might be one difference, is that when you're playing horseshoes, you kind of throw them level, in a sense. I mean, you're still aiming at something on the ground, but you don't really... I guess it depends. You obviously can throw them higher in the air, but with lawn darts, to get them to fall right, you had to throw it high.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have the option, and it says victims are often bystanders, so I'm imagining people standing, just watching the game, not paying attention, drinking a beer or something.
Yeah.
And,
not paying attention, and then the person that throws it loses control or something, and
throws it wrong, all of a sudden, you know, there's this foot-long dart flying at your skull.
Yeah, and they don't have the benefit of a horseshoe because those are so damn heavy that you can't loft them as high, you know. These kids can't loft them really high because there's a lot of weight to them. I mean, they do sell, like, plastic, heavy plastic-type horseshoes now, but they were metal back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you still get metal horseshoes. Maybe not though.
All right, so I've got one. I remember this one because my friend had this this kit, and we enjoyed the hell out of it. But it was called the Creepy Crawlers Fright Factory, where you'd actually make bugs and little creatures and stuff. But it had a hot plate.
And
it was hotter than hell, and the chemicals that you used to make these creatures could be toxic. So I couldn't find any deaths or anything, but there were a lot of hospital incidents where kids burned themselves pretty bad and got sick because of the toxicity of the stuff you were playing with. And there were several incidents of kids burning their fingerprints off. So, yeah, I remember this toy, and I played with it a lot. And nobody ever told me how to play with it, unlike lawn darts. Mm-hmm. It just, as a kid, I knew hot was hot, right? I didn't put my hand on the plate. I knew I was making something, but, yeah, that was... Creepy Crawly's Fright Factory.
That's awesome. That reminds me, one of the ones I wanted to look a little bit more into that I didn't play with was, I don't know if you saw it, was from the 50s, and it was an atomic.
Oh, I did see that. I did see that. The lab kit?
Yeah, it was an atomic lab kit.
Yeah, I've never played with that, but it sure looked interesting. I did have something, but I didn't find it in the Danger Toys, but when I think about it, it was dangerous, was the Erector set, because it had sharp metal pieces. But it inspired you to create stuff like pulleys and weights and elevator shafts and all this cool stuff, because there were engines and stuff that you could hook up to it. But now that I look at it, when I had the Erector set, I remember cutting myself a lot because of the metal sheets that came with it. You know, they were sharp.
Yeah. Sorry, Luna's barking downstairs. She must see something outside. Either sees a dog walking by or people.
Yeah, Harley's looking at me like, I gotta go for my walk. What's up?
Yeah, she's protecting the house, Luna. That's good. Well, the other one I had was Slip and Slide.
Oh, that was one I had on my list, too.
Yeah.
Did you have one?
Yeah. Yeah, we had one. I know some other kids. I guess they came out in a lot of different names. But, because these were around for a long time, it looks like, from, like, the 60s till the early 90s.
But aren't they still around, just in a different form? Like,
maybe.
Much safer, much thicker. You can't get enough speed to hurt yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, they weren't super thick. You had to be careful when you laid them down. You didn't lay them down over top of a rock or something. Because we never got hurt seriously, but I think I did. Actually, sometimes so these were, whether you call them slip and slide or they had some different names, there was like one called the wet banana, I think. But basically, it was a long yellow, it was plastic or just a thin, and it had, you hooked it up to a hose and it had little spouts alongside so that the slide would stay wet, and you just laid it flat on the ground. Sometimes they would have a little pool at the end of it, and you basically got on your baby and just went running at it and then threw yourself down and slid, or at least supposed to slide down the length of it. And you know, part of the problem of that, like I said already, it wasn't thick enough that it protected you from the landscape beneath it. So if you set it up somewhere where there was a hard part of the ground, or you didn't see a rock or something like that underneath, sometimes you would get that right in the stomach or knee or something like that when you threw yourself down on it. But yeah, the thing from the safety commission that I found about this one says that they're designed for use by children only, and part of the problem was that adults and teens were using them, and because of their height and weight difference from kids, they could hit the slide and abruptly stop. And I guess some people ended up with permanent spinal cord injuries from ended up quadriplegic or paraplegic as a result.
Yeah.
Of spinal cord injuries and stuff like that. So, no, that didn't happen to anybody I knew, but yeah, I could see how, in hindsight, I could see how it could have.
Mm-hmm. So,
you had one too?
I didn't have one personally, but my friends had one and I played in their yard.
Yeah.
So, I never had one where we actually hooked it up, but I got hurt a couple times. I mean, nothing drastic, but
right.
I'd get burned, like I'd slip off and burn my knee on the grass or something. It's like,
oh yeah, that happened.
It's like getting a carpet burn because you're sliding right on this plastic, but you accidentally slide off because whatever, you know, your momentum takes you off of the slide by accident, and you get these carpet burns, like from the grass, or depending on, you could get cement burns. I don't know, there's all kinds of stuff, but never got hurt to where, you know, scabby, or you know, it's all kid injuries that you're used to.
Yeah, I guess I'm more cautious now because I think about, I didn't really have any hesitation in doing these when I was a kid, but now I'm thinking. If I was standing there looking at this, a slip and slide, I'd think I'd pass.
Yeah, I would maybe try it, but I wouldn't definitely go all out because I still have that mentality as a kid to try stuff. I don't know. I tried rolling down a hill one time because we used to do that as a kid. Just
yeah,
you have these parks that have these huge hills, mm-hmm. and we would just roll off of them. And me and my brother did this, and we were in our late 30s, and I almost passed out. I gained too much momentum and went down that.
Dang.
Yeah. The keys stabbed me. I had them in my pants pocket. So, yeah, oh, it's like I try stuff, but I'm getting too old for this shit. Another interesting one I saw was the click clackers, but I never had those.
I've actually seen them.
I've seen my friends play with them, but I've never played with them other than seen people play with them, but these were dangerous objects. They were like two marbles on a string that you would click and clack back and forth together to make these huge loud noises. And they actually look cool when you do it, because you do it really fast.
Yeah.
But if you got clocked with this damn thing, you'd be in a lot of pain, I tell you.
Yeah, they're essentially a weapon. Yeah. I think they actually are fairly similar to some martial arts weapons.
Yeah, like a ninja weapon.
Yeah. Like bol, what do they call it? Bolus or something like that? Like a bigger, like basically a bigger version of them. You can throw them to trip somebody.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, when I've hung out with the Ninja Turtles in the past, they've used them at least.
Yeah, it's like what Talisman had and threw at Invisible Woman in Contest of Champions. There were click clackers.
I think I never had any. I don't think I've picked them up here and there in the past. I think I remember smashing my fingers in between them accidentally.
The one thing I wanted to mention, because I did have this, and I got the next generation of it, and I was usually disappointed, but I had a Viper, a Battlestar Galactica first generation Viper. I still have it somewhere in the basement. But it actually had a... Where the laser shot out in the TV show, well, actually the front part of the Viper, it had a projectile where you could press the bottom and it would projectile the missile. It would shoot the missile out. And it had a pretty significant distance. Like, you could probably shoot it across a room. And I guess people were poking their eyes out and stuff, because when I ended up getting the Cylon one, it sucked. You'd actually press it and the missiles would come out, but they would just fall flat. It was like, it had no propulsion whatsoever. Yeah. And then it's an attached missile, so it would just go like 5 inches and... Huge disappointment. But that was an interesting thing. A lot of toys would do that back in the day, as they, you know, like, you'll even watch Toy Hunter now and they'll say, does it still launch? And
I think a lot of some of the G.I. Joe toys and stuff had, you know, they would have missiles on the vehicles and stuff that you'd press a button, they'd shoot off.
They're cool missile type stuff. And then over time you see the object get more blunted and have a Nerf end to it and that kind of stuff.
That's the problem nowadays with toys. Is if you want to shoot your eye out, there's like
you got
no way to go about it. Yeah.
You got the pellet and BB gun, though. You can always do that.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can get them at the age, like, comics were advertising BB guns for, like, 5-year-olds. Like, get your dad to teach you how to shoot your BB gun.
Right, yeah.
Turn 5. Like, right now, I think you have to be, like, a teenager to purchase one or something.
I think so.
They've probably taken power off of them, too.
Yeah. That's
significant.
Yeah, I imagine.
That was a fun topic.
Yeah.
And then we got our next set of questions. It was like our top 5 childhood crushes.
Mm-hmm.
I'll start off with one of mine. This was my very first one.
Did you do these in any kind of order? Or?
No order, but it's kind of order of time, I think. As we go along, I'm getting older and older.
Yeah, how far did you consider childhood to mean?
I went all the way to, I think, junior high.
Yeah, me too. That's kind of where I focused before.
I might have been a freshman, I don't know, on the last one I did. But my very first one was was Miss Crabtree in The Little Rascals. The Little Rascals were before my time, but I'd always catch them in reruns.
Nice.
And just like the kids back then who were always bringing her apples and all that stuff, you know, they were all in love with her too. So was I. So I thought Miss Crabtree was the shit. I really liked her back in the day.
Who played her?
I have no idea. I didn't even research her. But I probably can find her on Google right now while you're giving me
All right, well, I'll do mine kind of in the same way, like same sort of order chronologically. This is the one that I mentioned last time, actually, was Daisy Dukes. Catherine Bach was the actress. And I know that my next one will probably be around the same time, but it's probably one of the earliest shows I ever watched. And it's definitely before, like, it wasn't like a lust thing. I just remember, you know, really liking the character and not totally understanding why. But I watched Dukes of Hazzard a lot as a kid, so I definitely had to put Daisy Duke on the list there.
Her short shorts.
And her short shorts, yeah. made me feel funny. Wasn't sure why.
Yeah, that same thing for Little Rascals. I think I was watching the Little Rascals become infatuated with her, and that's how I did. You know what I mean? But mm-hmm. Now that I look at images of her, her name was June Marlowe. She was hot, man. Holy crap. She was smoking. I still think she's hot now. I don't know if she'd be in my top five now, but she'd be up there. She's pretty smoking. So that was a good choice. I think the next one for me, and I can't remember in terms of order, but was Farrah Fawcett from Charlie's Angels. I always watched Charlie's Angels, and I think I was just a horny guy because I liked to watch it a lot, but there was never, like, I was always infatuated with all these women doing adventures. Mm-hmm. So, and she was a model at the time. Like, you couldn't go anywhere and not see Farrah Fawcett's poster, like at a state fair or something. You'd want to, like, win the mirror of Farrah Fawcett or the poster of Farrah Fawcett, something you put on your wall. But
one of the iconic images of the 70s, I think. For sure.
So we need to definitely put a montage of, like you did with our comic covers, of the women.
Yeah. the women of Geek Brunch
Retro. Yeah, retro, yeah.
Well, my next one is kind of the same time period as my last one, and I almost didn't want to put her on the list because I always want to be different, you know? I never want to like the same thing or do the same things as other people, but I definitely didn't care about that when I was a kid. And so my next one is Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia.
Oh, you had a crush on her?
Yeah. And that's why I still kind of like, because Princess Leia is very sarcastic, kind of has an attitude.
Oh, yeah, a strong female.
And it wasn't so, I mean, it's such a stereotype to, like, this whole slave Leia thing, and I think when I saw, I think I was still too young. Like, again, this one is kind of when I was born after the first movie came out, so this was still, I was pretty young, so I don't think it was a lust thing so much as this was a girl in a, you know, one of my favorite movies when I was a kid, so I think it was just, you know, one of the, definitely when I think back to the very early memories, Princess Leia is in there. And the, sort of the same way as Daisy Duke, you know. Some of the first pretty ladies I saw on TV.
Well, I think if I was a kid when Slave Leia came out, I would have been blown away. I'm still blown away. It's like, look, at cons when you go and there's Slave Leia's walking by, I just can't take my eyes off. You know, it used to be, when I was younger, you would be taught to look away, but it's harder when you get older. You know, your eyes don't look away as fast. It's like, stay on target. Wow, look at that. But, I get hypnotized to this day with the slave Leias at conventions.
And I think they're walking around at conventions, at least according to Tony Harris. That's what.
Yeah. They don't even like Star Wars.
Yeah.
Let's see what my next one would. The next one I had is Linda Carter from Wonder Woman. I'm still posting pictures of her on my Facebook wall. Every now and then I'll see a picture of her as Wonder Woman, and she was a damn beautiful woman. And I had a childhood crush on her. She's still pretty. Like, I think she appeared in a couple of movies, and she's still pretty damn gorgeous for her age, man.
And she's one of the, like, sometimes when you go back, you know, and look at, I think this is more of a problem for the 80s right now because of 80s style and stuff like that. You go back and look at the styles and you're like, ooh. But it's not the case really for Linda Carter in the Wonder Woman. Like, I have a current crush on Linda Carter as Wonder Woman. You know, I have the, I watched some of the first season last year or something like that on DVD.
Yeah.
And she's, I mean, she, it holds up. I mean, she's very beautiful.
Yeah, there's this guy I follow on Facebook. His name is Terry Soto, and he does a lot of, like, his whole thing is, like, classic TV. Like, that's what he specializes in. Like, he's, he worked at Captain Celluloid's movie and TV World and stuff like that, so he's, like, real infatuated with older movies and stuff like that. Uh-huh. And lately he's been posting some Linda Carter things, and they're amazing because they're like offset, you know. She's just gorgeous. She's gorgeous, man.
Like when she's like not shots from when they were rolling, but when she's
He seems to get like exclusive photos of them when they're just caught walking down the street and shit like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but she's a very pretty woman.
So I'm trying to think chronologically. I don't know exactly which would be next, but I'll say another one of mine was Elizabeth Shue.
I know her from Karate Kid.
That would be the main one. There was definitely some others that she was in around that time. Yeah, but and my attraction to her is definitely, like, as I've grown up, it's continued as she's grown up and I've grown up, but it's definitely because of Karate Kid. Was one of my favorite movies as a kid. I still love it. I still watch it every once in a while. I've seen it a million times, and I just identified so much with Ralph Macchio's character in that movie, and he's kind of the underdog, the weird kid from, you know, out of town. There's definitely like an ethnic quality to it. Is he's this New York kid or this East Coast kid coming to the West Coast? And I mean, I never did that. I'm still on the East Coast, but
but you know karate, so you could identify.
Right, but I'm a karate master, so that part of it. I wish I quit. I achieved the white belt in karate. I never got past that. I quit. That was my. The thing that I was really good at as a kid was quitting. Everything except for conflicts and video games.
You started karate, things and never finished them.
Soccer, musical instruments. I was a professional quitter. But Elizabeth Shue as his love interest in the movie. As he's, you know, she's no longer interested in the California boys, and you know, she's the sequence where he goes to the. He goes to the Halloween party dressed up as the shower, and she comes inside the shower with him, and they dance inside the shower, and she ends up kissing him. I still, like, I watched it like last year. I'm in my 30s, and I'm still like identifying with him again, and oh, Elizabeth Shue is so beautiful.
It's a great movie, though. You could catch it. You could catch. I like one and two. I really do. And if they're on late at night, I'll rewatch it.
Oh yeah, I still get wrapped up in, you know, identifying with him and you know the ending and put him in a body bag.
The crane.
Yeah.
Wax on, wax off.
And the soundtrack is just, you know, that. still, like, especially...
Was that Peter Cetera, or was that the second one? I can't remember.
Yeah, it was the second one, but when they're... Survivor. You know, I still get pumped up when, you know... what's the name of the song?
You're the best! Yeah! That song? I'm gonna bring you down.
Yeah, it's like, I could put that on and, you know, I should use that as, like, you know, warm-up music to cut the grass or something. Or do crane kicks, one or the other, I don't know.
All right, the next one that I'm real fond of, and to this day, when I actually met her in person at San Diego Comic-Con, and I was just, like, blown away, and it's like, she's touching me! Ah! But, Erin Gray from Buck Rogers. Oh my God, would I have a crush on her.
I knew that and one was coming.
I freaking love Erin Gray. And, you know, she's been in other things, other TV shows. But when she was in Buck Rogers, my God, she's the most beautiful face I've ever seen. And, man, she was always wearing those smoking tight white costumes or the blue costumes because she was Commander Wilma Deering, and mm-hmm. I loved her. I also loved the girl that had the Tiger Man. I can't remember what her name was, but damn, she was sexy. She was always trying to have sex with Buck, and he was like, stop it some more. But I loved Buck Rogers, and man, Erin Gray to this day, I still love her. I think she's amazing. I follow her photos on Facebook. She's amazing.
She, like Linda Carter, she's another one that was before my time, but I've come to appreciate later on in life.
I think
that's like, I grew up in the 80s, but like the 70s, I think the 70s look right now is a little more, like, has lasted a little bit better. So,
yeah.
You know, they don't look as like women with the 70s style and stuff, I think, holds up a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my next one chronologically would, if I put these in order of how big a crush I had, would be number one. That's Alyssa Milano.
Oh, God. She was hot. Today she's still hot.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was a kid, obviously, this was more of a, like a, so the other ones I mentioned there, well, I guess Elizabeth Shue, when she did Karate Kid, she was only like 17 or 18, but, or maybe she was a little older, but, you know, this was more of, she was around the same age as me, or maybe a little bit older than me, but it was the whole, in the 80s, the whole Teen Beat, like, or teen, whatever, the magazines, like the Teen Idol magazines and stuff, and they were always pushing the different guys and girls that were like teen stars and stuff. Like for the girls, it was like the Coreys, Corey Haim and Corey Feldman, and so I used to get all these. I mean, in hindsight, it seems almost a little creepy, but I guess it was because I was a kid, it was okay. But I had like basically my wall in my bedroom was Alyssa Milano. I had like two normal posters, and then just all these, you know, you buy these teen magazines, and they'd have all these 8 by 8.5, 11. So I had all these pictures of Alyssa Milano all over my wall. It's like definitely the biggest crutch, and the first one that was really about, not just like I said with Daisy Duke or Princess Leia. I know I was drawn to them, but didn't really understand why. I definitely understood why I was interested in Alyssa Milano and Who's the Boss.
Yeah, that's. About a decade, she would have been in my list, but she was a little young for me when I was looking at her. But then she showed up like in Poison Ivy and Mark Wahlberg's, what was that movie? I can't remember what the heck it is. But I find her really sexy now. She's fantastic.
Yeah, she seems pretty. She's one of those rare childhood stars that didn't get like hugely effed up for a while there. I mean, she had a little, like you said.
Yeah, you mentioned Corey Feldman and Corey Haim. Right. Those guys got fucked up.
Well, yeah, Corey Haim's dead.
Yeah, they're fucked up. They had some bad drug times, man.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was even some, that went through it and came out of it, like, say, like Drew Barrymore, you know, she had issues, now she's okay, but...
Or Bonducci.
Yeah.
From the Partridge Family.
Yeah, yeah.
It's crazy. So, my last was Kelly LeBrock, and this was towards later on, but when she was in Weird Science, man, oh, God. She was just so smoking hot. And then she appeared in The Woman in, I think it was called the, I can't remember if it was The Lady in Red or The Woman in Red. It's a Gene Wilder movie.
Yeah.
And, oh, man, I'll still watch that movie and think she's smoking hot. But, yeah, I was a huge fan of Kelly LeBrock. She's one that got really messed. She didn't age well like some of these others we're talking about. You'll see photos of her being arrested and shit, and she just looks terrible. But, yeah, she was definitely a crush I had.
Yeah, she's a big one you see on a lot of lists, like 70s, 80s crushes, you know?
Yeah.
Again, a little before my time, but one that, you know, you become aware of it because you hear so many other people, especially because of Weird Science. And, you know, another one that's always on the list with her is Phoebe Cates because of Fast Times.
Oh, yeah, that's...
But I didn't see that till later on.
The bathroom scene.
Yeah.
I remember the song. They're playing the Cars during that scene.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's from their first album.
Was it like Just What I Needed or something?
No, it's do 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 do. I can't even remember what that song is, what the title of it is, but I can hum it.
Yeah.
Life is Strange. I can't remember what the heck it goes. The Cards album, the first one, is by far their best. I mean, it's just so good. Everything on that album is awesome.
Yeah, it's one of those ones you listen to and realize that, like, 7 out of the 10 songs were, like, hit singles, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And the ones that weren't are still good songs, you know?
Uh-huh. You had a time period where there were bands, like, pumping out really good quality CDs or albums or tapes, whatever you're getting at the time. And then you had an era in the 80s where it was like one hit wonders, like you buy based on the hit and then the rest of the album was crap. It was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
So yeah,
I think MTV had something to do with that.
Yeah,
people would see videos, you know, catch on, songs would catch on through their videos. Back when MTV showed videos. Well, my last one, chronologically, this would have been middle school, late middle school, when I was very, very aware of why I was drawn to, was Cindy Crawford.
Oh, from Vacation?
She's like modeling
on everything. She was on every magazine.
She was just everywhere in the 80s as a model. You know, Sports Illustrated swimsuit, and she was just all over the place. And now she's, I don't know, not that she's not pretty, but she's a little boring. Maybe it was because she was everywhere. If I was, say, like my top 5 celebrity crushes now, she wouldn't be on there. But I definitely have to say, back in the day, you know, when I was in middle school and stuff, I had this, and it's funny to me to admit it now, because, you know, once I got into high school, I was more of like a punk rock.
So was I.
Yeah, like, I know I hear you talk like to Bill about it on Geek Brunch and stuff.
Yeah, Bill had a chain belt. Leather pants. Matter of fact, we had a Secret Santa one year. We used to do the Geek Brunch Secret Santa. And the thing with the Secret Santa is you'd put like a list of stuff, like trades you want, between the price of $10 and $20 or something like that. You'd get to pick one for that, but you wouldn't know who your Secret Santa was. And then you'd have to draw a sketch. And the last one I got Bill on, and I drew a picture of him as a punk rocker.
Nice.
A punk rocker dad. He had his kid there.
Yeah, I had pretty much every... My hair was pretty much every possible color you can buy in high school.
I never colored my hair, but I had a half mohawk. Like, I had one side of my head shaved completely.
Nice.
It was more like a new wave haircut, I think. Because one side was, like, nearly bald, but then I had a lot of hair on the other side. That was weird.
I used to shave almost all my head. I shaved all my head except for hair in the front, and I would dye that. It was really easy to take care of. But the reason I say that, because I, you know, in high school I turned into the type of person that wouldn't have a Cindy Crawford poster on the wall, probably.
Yeah.
But in middle school I did have a Cindy Crawford poster, and I remember me and my friend, our parents take turns driving us to the mall, and they would just drop us off at the mall, and we'd walk around, go to the arcade and stuff, and we'd get, you know, all dressed up in, like, our Cavaricci pants and shit, and you know, just meet girls there and stuff. But I remember we both went into the record store and bought posters with women on them. We're both... I remember the cashiers were laughing at us. They were older, like older teenagers or like people in their 20s, and they were laughing at us for buying the posters. We were like younger kids. This, my poster was like Cindy Crawford. She was wearing like cutoff shorts. Must be the Daisy Duke thing.
She was wearing cutoff shorts. And it, National Lampoon's Vacation, one of the sexiest scenes ever, is the pool scene where she takes her clothes off and jumps in the pool, and Chevy Chase is like...
Was that Cindy Crawford?
I thought so. Oh, no, that wasn't Cindy Crawford. That was the lady that married Billy Joel.
Oh, Christie Brinkley.
Brinkley.
Yeah. I knew her from the Billy Joel video. That was when I first found out about her. Uptown Girl.
What was Cindy Crawford in? Like, I know she was a model everywhere, but wasn't she in quite a few movies too? Or
I think her modeling ended up... She ended up parlaying that into kind of a crappy movie career. I don't think she was ever the greatest actress. But I'm picturing in my mind, I'm looking it up now because I know she was in the movie. I think she was in a movie with one of the Baldwin brothers.
Bodyguards? I don't know. I don't see too much in their film career.
No, she didn't do a lot
of that. A lot of sitcom stuff.
I don't think she was very successful. Fair Game with William Baldwin as Detective Max Kirkpatrick. She was Kate McQueen. Max Kirkpatrick is a cop who protects Kate McQueen, a civil law attorney, from a renegade KGB team out to terminate her. It has 3.9 out of 10.
That was a good movie.
Its Metascore is 13. So, yeah.
Yeah, it seems like she's in a lot of comedies or TV shows, but probably just as not reoccurring, but just showing up.
Yeah, I think she's pretty much famous for being herself. Nowadays, she sells skincare products, I think. I know I was flipping through the channel and she was selling some kind of skincare product that she uses.
Well, she's known for her videos, too, like her body workouts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. So, I think my favorite, you said yours was Alyssa Milano, mine is Erin Gray. I still think she's top notch.
Yeah, if I put mine in, like I said, Alyssa Milano, then it would be Elizabeth Shue. And both of them, like I said, kind of, I would still count them as, you know, as they've gotten older, I'd still count them as attractive.
Right.
You know, and cool. They both seem like cool people. Alyssa Milano likes baseball, so that's a plus for her. I'm sure she cares. Yeah. But I think that's cool.
So last but not least, you want to jump into the fourth world Omnibus.
Hell yeah.
And this one we're covering Forever People number one, New Gods number one, and Mr. Miracle number one.
Yep.
And just before we start, I have to admit, I found the first three stories to have a lot more depth.
I see what you're saying.
I enjoyed them a lot more as far as, like, plot.
I can see that.
Yeah. These ones I enjoyed a lot, but I think the order that I enjoyed them in, well, I think I enjoyed Mr. Miracle the best. But he's always been what I think he was. He was my first character that I guess introduced me to Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
I still think he has the coolest costume. I just love the colors and the way it mixes and the discs he flies on. And
yeah, I can remember seeing pictures of him when I was a kid. As I've said before, I didn't read much DC as a kid, but I was in the comic shop, so I'd see pictures, and I would see him on Justice League covers, and it's still hard for me to get it out of my head that there's a human inside the costume, because when I was a kid, I thought he looked like a robot. So it just got fixed in my head, and I know he's not a robot, but in my mind, I always want him to be a robot, because when I was a kid, I thought he looked like one.
Yeah, my first Mr. Miracle was not even a Jack Kirby version of it. It was a DC Comics Presents. Superman and Mr. Miracle, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought he was awesome. And then since then, I was like digging into the back issues trying to find this character, because back in the day, those team-up books would introduce you to characters, and you're like, who is this character? I got to find more about that character.
Yeah, that's a whole topic in itself, just how these characters have been picked up and used by DC, you know. But yeah, I think I saw the cover of that DC Comics Presents when I did an image search for a picture of Oberon to use as my Twitter profile.
Yeah.
Before I was sitting there going, Kirby, Kirby. So I changed my name to Oberon and...
The other thing I found a little bit disappointing in the first story was Superman's continuity with the first three issues, I guess. Because it seemed like he wanted to really go find Supertown to find people more like him in this one.
Yeah.
But then he had that whole adventure in the first three stories, and it's almost like he didn't even retain that happened.
Yeah, I saw that issue too. It doesn't seem... Both him and Jimmy Olsen don't seem to have had... It's almost as if Forever People won, even though it came out after...
Yeah.
It almost is like it happened before those, because there's no sign that they had the experiences in the three issues of Jimmy Olsen that we talked about last time.
Yep, that was my only disappointment in the reading. That was the only thing that like made me think like, wow, is this really in order? Or
yeah,
threw me off. It really did.
Yeah, I'll retroactively be his editor and say that it takes place before. This book takes place before Jimmy Olsen 130.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. It's hard for me to say whether I like these better or worse, just because I like them so much because of the concepts introduced and the characters introduced.
Mm-hmm.
So amazing, and the character designs. In some ways, you're right. I definitely can see how you're saying that they're not as dense in terms of plot. It's almost as if we get a lot of plot in the Jimmy Olsen issues, and then these three are they're almost filling in background in some ways, almost. We're finding out more about this fourth world saga that he's setting up, some of the players that are involved, but you know, it's not as densely plotted. But I liked them a lot. I guess it's hard for me. I loved all of them, but you said Mr. Miracle was probably your favorite. It probably was my least favorite of the three. New Gods was probably, well, it's a toss-up between New Gods and Forever People, but if I was forced, I'd probably put New Gods first, Forever People second.
I think the New Gods was my least favorite. In terms of concept, it was my favorite.
Yeah.
In terms of design and concept, it was my favorite. In terms of plot, I think it was my least favorite.
I can see that. I think I'm just so overwhelmed by the concepts right now that, you know, it's so amazing to me, the concepts that and the character designs that's probably the thing that I focused on the most, but I can totally see what you're saying.
I do like that Inner Gang is appearing in everything.
Yeah.
I really like it. They're really prominent. And they seem to have a different gangster leader every time we see them.
And they're so, even though this is the 70s, they're so totally like a 40s or 50s gang. You know, they seem totally out of, like, you know, they'd be like, Kirby would be running into these guys and when he was a kid, you know, in New York City or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that I kind of love about the Fourth World Saga is that, you know, he takes these concepts. It's like he didn't care. He was going to take anything that he liked or was interested in and make it work somehow. So Intergang, you know, is teaming up and being used by this god from another universe, you know. And the Newsboys are involved, and, you know, it's just these things that are Kirby things that he liked from his earlier comic work. He pulls them in here.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And they should be, they shouldn't work, but they do. So, you want to talk Forever People number one a little more in depth?
Yeah, sure. Again, Jack Kirby did everything.
Mm-hmm.
And
Kirby cover.
It's got Superman on the cover. Mm-hmm. I found it real interesting cover. What struck me on this cover is obviously they're trying to sell the book with Superman, right? Because
mm-hmm.
these are new characters, but everybody knows Superman, so throw Superman in. But mm-hmm. I thought it was weird how they put Beautiful Dreamer in the corner of the book. And hers is the only name that makes the cover. You know, it's like Beautiful Dreamer. Yeah, it's just right there. I thought it struck me because you have all the main characters on this super cycle. It's freaking awesome. And Superman flying with them. And is his name Viken? I can't pronounce it. I'm going to say Viken.
That's how I would say it.
But yeah. He's got the cool mother box. And it's interesting about the size of the mother box. It's huge. It's fucking huge.
Yeah.
And later on, you'll see the mother boxes get smaller and smaller.
Yeah, well, I think it's suggested that Mr. Miracle has one, and his is really small.
Yeah, really small.
Comparatively. But yeah, his is like a... Viken's is like a boombox, almost. Yeah, it is funny how normally if you had Beautiful Dreamer, the way that Beautiful Dreamer is featured on the cover, normally that would be to let you know that there's a backup story about a character in case you wanted to appeal to people for the character, or just to let you know that a popular character was appearing there, but it didn't make sense for the composition of the cover. But she's a new character, too. You know, so it's not like anyone would be like, oh, Beautiful Dreamer's in this.
Yeah, why not have Big Bear on the cover? Because, yeah. I mean, if any of the characters, to me, strike me on the cover, it's Big Bear.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's huge. Yeah.
Try the boom tube. If you dare. Yeah. But I like the composition. Like, just as a visual, I like the cover a lot.
Oh, it's a beautiful cover.
Yeah.
I can look at it for hours. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's a good one. And speaking of the boom tube, that's how the story starts, is we get several panels of the boom tube. And as Kirby loved to do... on the second page, we get second and third pages, we get a double page splash. I'm going to mess up that phrase every time. Double page splash of the Forever People. And it's just awesome. I love. Sometimes if there's too many double page splashes in a comic book, I get irritated because I want my content.
Yeah.
But Kirby can do it all the time if he wants to. I don't care.
Yeah, me neither.
Just awesome because we got this, the super cycle comes flying out of the boom tube, and four of the Forever People are Big Bear's enjoying it. Everyone else is freaking out.
Yeah, Viking looks angry. The other two guys look shocked. Like, oh shit, they have the oh shit faces.
Yeah. So yeah, we got Big Bear driving
Seraphim. Viking,
and then the other two are Seraphim and Mark Moonrider. He's in the front. He looks like he could fall out.
And it's interesting how he gave his name Mark. Like, why couldn't he just be called Moonrider? Was there another Moonrider, like a copyright thing? And he said, I'll just throw Mark in front of it.
Yeah, maybe. Or he's...
Everybody else has unusual names, but he's got Mark.
Mm-hmm.
I found that interesting.
Maybe in Supertown, you know, there's a prominent politician named Moonrider that he went... Doesn't want to be confused. And they are from Supertown, as I said, and they're coming to rescue Beautiful Dreamer. They're the lady of the Forever People, their fifth member. And who has them other than Darkseid? Darkseid has kidnapped her. But they arrive suddenly and almost run a few... Well, they actually do run a few teenagers driving off the road, off a cliff.
Off a cliff, yeah.
And so they have to save them before they plummet to their deaths. And we first get the Mother Box coming into play because Viking uses the Mother Box. And it goes ping, ping, ping. That's what the Mother Box speaks.
Hey, that was awesome. Did I tell you I tweeted, you know, that I was reading that stuff and Mother Box retweeted me and it said ping, 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 ping. That was awesome.
Yeah, did you look at the Twitter feed? That's all it is.
Yeah, it's just a bunch of pings, but I'm like, fuck, that's awesome. Yeah.
It must, like, anytime the Forever People comes up, it pings them.
Yeah, or the Kirby or something. Like
Kirby or
New
something
Gods,
like that.
Yeah. But interesting enough, the guy that they run off the road or to his death,
that's
but
awesome.
They save him, is Jimmy Olsen's friend. That's what I thought was weird.
Bobby.
Yeah, he happens to take pictures of him to give to Jimmy.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and we got nearby spying on the Forever People arriving is the Intergang. Like you said, the Intergang are there and... Observing them for Darkseid.
Did you notice that Seraphim was like, he's trying to hit on that dude's.
Yeah,
and
Lori.
He's like giving her flowers and shit.
Yeah, he picks flowers and brings them to her. What are they? And the other Forever People are just like, they're used to it. It
yeah.
seems like they're used to him hitting on chicks. He's like, what do they say? They're used to, he say, oh yeah. Moonriders. Big Bear says, young Seraphim is doing his big hero bit. And in the background, he's handing the flowers to the girl. And Mark Moonrider says, Seraphim turns on with fantasies. He's a sensitive. But they're going to need him if they're going to contact Beautiful Dreamer. So I guess he's... Because, yeah, he's... On the next page, he makes contact with Beautiful Dreamer. So he has kind of some mental powers. And I guess that makes him... He's sensitive to emotion, so that's why he's real... That's why he's a ladies' man.
Yeah, and it looks like he has, like, a seizure and passes out, but he's really
yeah,
in contact.
And that's why he wears white jeans and a green cape and a cowboy hat. He looks like a kid that dressed himself as a superhero. But, yeah, so, yeah, like you said, Guy Bobby, he's friends with Jimmy Olsen and gives Jimmy Olsen the photos he took, and he shows them to Superman, And Superman uses his powerful vision to look deeper into the photograph of the boom tube, and he can see Supertown in the distance. So he excuses himself and turns Clark Kent, rather, turns into Superman, and goes flying off to investigate. And he's spotted by the Inner Gang, who contact Darkseid, and Darkseid tells him to go after Superman, because there's definitely a sense that Superman is seen as the main threat of Earth by Darkseid and his plans. So he sends the Inner Gang after Superman with their Sigma guns.
And they blast him right out of the sky. Mm-hmm. But he knocks out their helicopter or whatever they're in.
Yeah, he rips a tree out of the ground and throws it at him.
Yeah, and just like in G.I. Joe, they have parachutes. Do you notice that?
Yeah, I thought it was good that Superman... I'm glad that Superman knew they would survive.
Yeah, he aggressively threw that thing in the air and smashed the shit out of that thing, but everybody had a parachute.
Yeah. He must have knew that, because obviously he wouldn't be trying to kill him. So the Forever People, they think, and they assume that Superman's from Supertown. So they're like, we didn't think anybody that powerful was on this planet. Superman ends up teaming up with them, and he uses his X-ray vision to find a secret metal valve in the ground nearby, which Big Bear immediately rushes in that direction to try to save Beautiful Dreamer, and a bunch of toxic gas and gravity guards come out.
Those guards look pretty awesome. They're like purple or maroon type creatures that gang up on Superman.
Yeah, they almost look like orcs or something. Mm-hmm. And they got yellow underwear and helmets on.
And then we get the cool scene where they actually hit the mother box and they join to form Infinity Man to fight these creatures.
Yeah, it's almost like they trade places in a way, like they disappeared to allow him to come through. Something like that.
Did you happen to see the Young Justice cartoon that had the Forever People?
Yes.
That was awesome.
Yeah. And Superboy was riding Infinity Man.
Yeah, yeah.
So cool. That's one of the things I love about Young Justice. And I liked about Batman Brave and the Bold, too, is they weren't afraid to pull obscure characters in.
Yeah, yeah.
Infinity Man is not just powerful. He has a pretty good idea what's going on. Like, he fills Superman in. Because it's through him that we find out the reason Darkseid took Beautiful Dreamer is because she's one of the things that's central to this whole Fourth World saga is the concepts of the life and anti-life equations. And we find out a little more about those in New Gods, number one. But Darkseid wants to get the anti-life equation, and Beautiful Dream is one of the few who has a mind who can fathom it, who can fathom the anti-life equation. And we finally see Darkseid for real, a real appearance, not on a screen or anything. He actually shows up when Infinity Man calls him out.
And he does these radiant bombs, right? Launches the bombs, and Superman manages to save Infinity Man and Beautiful Dreamer.
Yeah, they're like attached to the table she's on.
Yeah.
Like
Darkseid
doesn't have any further use for her. He wasn't able to, you know, break her mind. He's going to go find somebody else that he can use to get the equation. So he just leaves her there, but he leaves her on a table that's trapped. Superman speeds past the explosion.
And they're all reunited and happy to see him, and Superman's, no, I want to go to Funky Town. Like, send me to Supertown. And they make a boom tube. Mm-hmm. And here's where I didn't quite understand what happened in the boom tube, but he didn't quite make it through.
It seems like, the way I took it was that he's really fixated on going to Supertown, because they're like, the Forever People are, don't, you know, we came from Supertown to here because this is where the problem is. Darkseid's here on Earth, and we need to stop him. This might not be the best time to go to Supertown. And at first, Superman's like, yeah, you can... just let me know if things get bad. I'll be back. I really want to go. Mm-hmm. And he's halfway there, I think, and then he starts to have second thoughts and realizes, oh, yeah, I guess maybe I shouldn't go. I guess I'll have to wait. Maybe I should stick around and help them. And he comes back, I think. That's kind of how I just took it. He's like, he has regrets immediately.
And this title was in 1971 in a bi-monthly series. A lot of these are bi-monthly, mm-hmm. and which is kind of unique, I think, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It ran 11 issues.
Yeah, that's so he'd have enough time to get everything done, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Because even Kirby, even though he was fast, doing 4 books.
Yeah.
All by himself, doing...
Writing and drawing, so...
Drawing, you know. That's crazy. But, yeah, I like this site, because I just... I mean, mostly because I like the Forever People and their design and Infinity Man, you know, just cool characters. And I like seeing Darkseid make a real appearance.
A lot of first appearances in there. All the Forever People.
Mm-hmm.
And Mother Box. It's first appearance of Mother Box, isn't it? Or did you see a Mother Box?
No, I don't think we saw one in the old Jimmy Olsen issues. I know. I know we did, and we only had the Inner Gang's more prominent here, too. We had some cameo appearances previously, but all the Forever People, Infinity Man, Darkseid in some ways. You know, a lot of times. They don't, you know, they consider a first full appearance when the character actually is
full figured,
full figured physically.
Or doing something, interacting. Every time we've seen him before as a screen.
Mm-hmm. He's just commanding, you know, his people, you know, whether it's Morgan Edge or the Intergang or whatever, the people that he's using for his plans, so.
I find it interesting in this title, too, how we don't really know what their powers are. I mean, you kind of get some hints. Mm-hmm. You have all these Forever People, but you really don't know what their abilities are other than they have a Mother Box.
Yeah, Viking seems to be the one that... Because he's, like, defensive of the Mother Box. He seems to really have almost a kind of a religious reverence for it, whereas... At least some of the other Forever People treat it like a machine, and he takes offense to that. But
seems to be the only one to understand it too, like to use it. Even though they all use it by touching it, becoming Infinity Man.
Yeah, but he's able to interpret the pings. He knows what it's saying,
mm-hmm.
but. Yeah, Seraphim, we get kind of an idea of what he can do. And Big Bear seems just kind of be the bruiser.
Just because he's big.
Big and tough.
And he knows how to drive.
Yeah. He is the wild man, the risk taker. He's kind of like the thing.
Mm-hmm. So we got the New Gods, which has a very interesting cover.
Yes.
Looks like you got a photo image in the background. Of a planet, and then you have Orion flying, you know, out of the screen into on the page.
Yep. And I noticed that Don Heck is the one that's credited along with Kirby instead of Vince Coletta for this cover. Kind of different. Yes, the script along the top says, when the old gods died, there arose the new gods. That's very much what happened.
Yeah, and you talked a little bit about this in the last episode about his passion for Thor, and you could kind of see a lot of similarities in this.
Yeah, because Thor and the Marvel Universe and Asgard and a lot of all that, that's very much taken from Norse mythology.
And in this case, New Genesis is kind of like Asgard.
Right. And Genesis being, you know, like the first book of the Bible is Genesis, and that I think that means beginning or something like that. So it's basically like new beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, the other planet. So basically, what's unique about this issue, which I thought was really cool, is it actually starts with an epilogue.
Yeah.
Which is the destruction of the old gods and their home, which is, that's like the Norse myth of Ragnarok, which is the destruction of the, you know, Asgard and all the old gods. And he conveys a sense of time passing, you know, like these two new planets, New Genesis and Apocalypse form, but he says that there's a time of silence. So it's basically, and that it was that way for an age. So he doesn't go specific, but he gives you the impression that for a while there was nothing but these planets just without life on them. So it's kind of, they're the, you know, the good and the bad, the yin and the yang, you know, New Genesis, a new beginning. Apocalypse is spelled differently, but it's obviously like an apocalypse, an ending. So it's almost like a beginning and an ending. And on the cover, you said we see Orion. That's who we are following, is Orion returning home to New Genesis.
Yeah, and he's the wielder of the Astro Force.
Mm-hmm.
You learn that.
Yeah,
and he immediately meets up with his buddy Light Ray,
mm-hmm.
who's polar opposite to Orion. He's very lighthearted and full of life, whereas Orion, I don't know if it's a lot of foreshadowing because we already know who Orion is, but he's a warrior and all about the war.
Yeah, I think he very much is foreshadowing that, you know.
Yeah.
They want to get across the fact that, you know, Orion is very much about fighting, and even though he is here on New Genesis and supposed to be a good guy, he definitely has conflict in his heart.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you want to call it. I thought it was cool that, you know, New Genesis is basically an unspoiled world. In other words, there's forests and, you know, you see their home is not really on the planet. It's a floating gold island that kind of floats above the earth, and the earth is still very unspoiled with civilization. It's a lot of nature. But that was cool. Orion's being called back by the High Father. He's kind of like Zeus, or sort of the patriarch of the whole of these new gods.
Yeah, I found it interesting how they bowed to the children.
Yeah, it was kind of cool.
Daryl Taylor should... I should take this photo and send it to Daryl, that the children are our future.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like... that fits right in. They could be singing We Are the World in the background there.
Yeah, I need to take this picture and send it to him.
The High Father and... the High Father and Michael Jackson and Diana Ross and Bruce Springsteen are singing to the children when Orion arrives. So
we get the first appearance of the Source Wall in this.
Yes, that's High Father takes Orion to the Chamber of the Source, where the Source Wall is, and we found out that the Source Wall, that's their link to the life equation, which is also a part of the High Father's staff. And it's the only thing that survived when the old gods died.
And it talks to them.
Mm-hmm.
And Mentron shows up for the first time with his Mr. Personality.
Yeah, I'm laughing because I love Mentron and Orion, their relationship. Orion doesn't like Mentron very much.
Well, isn't he like kind of like a, if you were to like a computer machine, like, wouldn't you say, like, He's no yeah, personality he's like, whatsoever, but like Data in Star Trek.
Yeah. Yeah, if he says he's like, if New Genesis is good and Apocalypse is bad, Metron is neutral.
Mm-hmm.
He even says, I don't care who's in power, I just want to know. I just want information. He's not interested. Yeah, information. He's not interested in good or bad. He just wants information. He's like, kind of reminds me. I mean, they don't always act like this, but in the Marvel Universe, the Watchers. You know.
Yeah.
He's just there to observe, and he's not on either side. And Orion, as someone who's interested in fighting and conflict and battle, he's. Doesn't mix well with Metron. He doesn't take very well to Orion doesn't take very well to Metron's impartiality. And Metron is on his Mobius chair. Mobius chair is important too.
Mm-hmm. And we get the first scene of Apocalypse.
Yeah, so the life equation, I thought I wrote down what it said, but it basically, oh yeah. So the words appear on the source wall, and it's kind of like prophecy, and it says, Orion to Apocalypse, hyphen, then to Earth, hyphen, then to war.
Right.
So
that's where he heads off to, Apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
And there, we get our first appearance of parademons. They attack him. And there's one scene in here I just love because it's like a scene out of OMAC when they're fighting. I think it's on the second page of when they're fighting. There's a scene of OMAC when he's smashing up a bunch of guards. There's when he's fighting a bunch of guards on the second scene. I just love it. A matter of fact, it looks almost identical to my OMAC one that I usually post as my Facebook fight scene.
Kind of like overwhelmed by all the parademons.
He's like punching them. It's I think where he's overwhelmed by the parademons is if you turn past the page where he flies by a Darkseid statue.
Yeah.
And then when they're fighting there.
Yeah.
Where they're all over him, but he looks like he's clobbering them.
Yeah, he's like fighting his way through the
pack. Yeah, that reminds me of an OMAC scene. That I have. Yeah.
Yeah, and we also get the dog cavalry. Which these are some scary.
Yeah, and this
tigers.
This guy here, like, looks so much like a, you know, that Mantis character.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's riding the dog, but I don't think it is.
No. You can see. His face is mostly covered by his gun, but you can see a little bit of his face. He's got a human face.
Yeah.
A little bit. But Ryan makes his way into basically the main Darkseid's main base, and he finds a mass director unit, which I assume is basically it's what he uses to rule Apocalypse, and transmit his orders. It's probably what he's communicating. When we see him in previous issues communicating with people on Earth, it's probably how he's communicating with them. Darkseid is not there. He's on Earth, as we know, but someone else is. In power while Darkseid is gone. Kalibak. Who basically looks like a caveman.
I love Kalibak.
Yeah, he's awesome.
But he looks like he's going to go clobber Orion, but mm-hmm. Guess who comes in? Mentron in his chair, and he blasted Kalibak and kind of put him in paralysis.
Yeah, it kind of imprisons him. And despite Orion not wanting any help from him, he doesn't. He's not thankful for the help. He doesn't want anything to do with Mentron. But we do find out that so he says that the old gods died, their bridge to Earth was destroyed, and, you know...
Rainbow Bridge.
Basically the Rainbow Bridge. They don't specifically say that, but... And we find out that Metron created the boom tube to replace the Rainbow Bridge, which I thought was kind of neat. It's almost like Kirby saying, like, okay, the Rainbow Bridge is kind of old-fashioned. The boom tube is, seems more futuristic and stuff.
Yeah.
Kind of neat. And Metron, yeah, this kind of info dump from Metron. He tells us a lot of information. This is how Orion finds out the Darkseid's actually on Earth. And
there's humans on Apocalypse.
Yes, which apparently is breaking a law. Breaking the High Father's command was...
Or agreed upon rules between New Genesis and Apocalypse.
Yeah. Bringing humans through the broom tube to Apocalypse.
It's almost like Zeus having sex with all the humans. Causes lots of problems.
Yeah. So, Metron leaves. And leaving, that releases Kalibak. So he attacks his club. He's, like I said, he looks like a caveman, but his club is kind of like a futuristic club. It's his beta club.
It's like he shoots Captain Caveman. So I thought these were always called like an astroglider. Maybe it is, but Metron brings him and then calls him the power rods.
Yeah, I don't know if the Astroglider is made up of power rods or...
Yeah, I've always known it as the Astroglider, but they don't mention Astroglider in here, do they? They mention Astroforce, but...
Yeah, I don't know if they call it that specifically. But, yeah, basically the issue ends with Metron, or rather Orion, rescues the humans and takes them back. Knowing that Darkseid's on Earth, he decides to go there through the boom tube. He takes the humans back, and it ends as the issue opened with an epilogue. It accordingly ends with a prologue as Orion shouts out a challenge to Darkseid, who hears and accepts.
This is by far the best art one, I thought.
Yeah.
Of the three.
Yeah, it's pretty sharp. And like I said, I think it was my favorite just because it's very... There isn't a lot of plot here, you know. I can see that as a criticism, but just conceptually, it's just so awesome. I mean, he's creating his own mythology here, you know. And it's definitely drawing from a lot of other mythology, but these concepts and ideas are so great, so really, so awesome. That I was really... It's these characters that you... I mean, I had never read this before, so these characters I'm familiar with from other places, and I know the basic gist of what's going on, but just seeing it literally, you know, specifically written out and reading the original source is just really fun.
Mm-hmm. So our last and final one is Mr. Miracle. He cheats death. He defies man. No trap can hold him.
Yeah.
And man, this brought a lot of memories back, but at the same time, it made me remember how much I've forgotten.
Hmm.
The cover is amazing. He's like strapped to a rocket, and Inner Gang is launching him into space. And all these titles say Kirby's here, like they're advertising, like, "Hey, he's joined DC now." He's no longer with the Marvel.
He's come to the other side.
Yeah.
We got Kirby.
And, man, I read this series, like, I think in the 90s, actually. Mm. Maybe early 90s. I know I read it in college. And, man, I just didn't remember it. But I didn't remember that Oberon was, like, you know, setting up death traps for him, and there was, and he's like, he's almost like setting up this death trap, and he's like, "Hey, we can't let that guy see that, you know, there's a fault here. There's only one guy watching,"
right?
And that's Scott Free, and I just thought that was goofy because he's like, you know, we can't let people see. We got to make this look as real as possible. You know, light me on fire, put me in the box, and light me up.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they're technically rehearsing the trick And so, I mean, I guess that makes sense. There wouldn't be an audience, but it definitely is convenient that Scott Free's
there. And at this time, it's really cool because Scott Free, you don't know anything about him at this point.
I do like that they, if you're going to name him Scott Free, I like that they, that the original Mr. Miracle, Thaddeus Brown, acknowledges that. So it's like a ironic name considering he's an escape artist, you know? Because if you're just going to throw that down there and just not even acknowledge that it's a pun, it's probably better to have Thaddeus react to it.
And Oberon seems really worried about Thaddeus. Like, hey, he's really pushing the limit. Like, he's getting too old for this shit.
Yeah.
And he could die at any moment if we don't get it right.
He's not really... He's reluctantly going along with it, but he's not happy about the risks set.
And then Inner Gang shows up again.
Yeah.
And you don't know why they show up, but they show up, and there's this one line that... the leader of Inner Gang is always like a gangster. And he says, button your lip, old man. The organization isn't crazy about introductions to strangers. And these two guards, he says, yeah, we think you smell, too. Yeah. I'm like, where did that come from? And then he says, your gimmicks are rusty. They drag, man. They drag. That's 70s talk right there.
Yeah, the dude that's like, he's almost like the dumb guy in the back, the dumb henchman. He's like, yeah, and you smell.
You smell. I laughed when I read that. I really did.
The other guys are like rolling their eyes behind their sunglasses.
Yeah.
Like, oh, man.
So I don't know if they're... Are they actually hired at this point to kill him? I don't know. They're hired to do something.
Yeah, well, their boss is Steelhand.
Yeah.
And
he sends the incompetent soldiers to go take him out. And you don't know why at this point.
No, you don't know why. I guess maybe they're just there to, like, throw their weight around, give them, like, bug them and stuff. Because we find out later that Mr. Miracle and Steelhand were in the hospital together. And they made a wager that Steelhand could, whether or not he could create a death trap that Mr. Miracle couldn't get out of. So they call it the big trap or something like that. So I guess they're kind of, Inner Gang's kind of there to put pressure on him to go through with the bet. And Mr. Miracle feels like he has to save face. Steel Hand's pretty literal, named pretty literally. He's a gangster with a steel hand.
Yeah, it's like he's...
Matches stuff.
He opens up with under radiation treatment. In Metropolis, mm-hmm. in some sealed room, and you learn that his steel hand could crush like a block of titanium. He like karate chops it and destroys it, and then they send a sniper to take out Thaddeus Brown, all over this stupid bet. I guess he made the bet because he needed the money.
Yeah, he says, and also just, you know, that's his whole, like, as a stunt man, as a risk taker, kind of like an Evel Knievel sort, you know, that's his whole... I can buy, like, the psychology of that, because I know, like, I've watched some documentaries about guys like this, like Evel Knievel and stuff, how, you know, they'll break every bone in their body, and then, you know, as soon as they're out of the hospital, they'll be setting up another stunt, you know?
Yeah.
They're pretty crazy, but yeah, in between, we get a sequence. Scott Free ends up going back. We find out he's an orphan. He seems to just be wandering around because he doesn't really have anywhere to go. So he goes back to Thaddeus's house with him and Oberon, and they give him a room to stay in. And Scott Free has this bag that he's carrying around with him, and he won't show anybody what's in it. But he reaches in there. He said, well, why don't you tie me up in chains? Why don't you? Sounds kinky, but... He's interested in doing some traps of his own, and he gets all bound up in chains, and he just stands there concentrating, and all of a sudden he blows all of the chains off of him. He just destroys them. They go flying.
Yeah, I found it real interesting, too, because it's almost like you got, like, different mentalities about escaping. One is very technical, like using gadgets and things to escape, and the other one was, you know, old-fashioned.
Yeah.
So you could like, see, like, a changing of the guard, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely some of that
this
there.
Guy was more like Houdini, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And whereas, at this point in time, you don't know where Scott Free's got all these gadgets from. You just know that he gets out of things very easy.
Yeah, he says he won't show them what's in the bag, and he says it's my inheritance. That's all. Things left with the foundling by parties unknown. So we don't know where he's got them from, but yeah, he's like the new school. He's Chris Angel.
Yeah. And the Steel Hand is still upset about the last failure, so he says, I'm going to take care of this mess myself, and he sends a sniper there. And mm-hmm. Thaddeus is practicing again with a bad situation.
This is even worse. Like, so he gets tied to a tree, and then there's this huge ramp, and Oberon goes up to the top of the ramp, and there's this enormous steel ball, and Oberon pushes the steel ball with a stick right in the direction of Mr. Miracle. I guess the idea is that he's got to get loose. But unfortunately, things go wrong.
Yeah, and Scott Free realizes that things are going to go bad, and he blasts the ball, basically, and makes it ricochet off with like his hand. This is the first time you see like a power, but you don't know if it's a power or what. But mm-hmm. he like makes the ball ricochet off. And he's like, you're too late, Scott. You know, while that was all happening, a sniper fired the bullet and shot Thaddeus in the chest.
Yep. He pretty much dies right there.
And we get another cool mother box scene. He's got it, like, strapped to his arm. And it's pinging all over the place.
Yeah, and if you didn't read Forever People, you really wouldn't know, wouldn't see the connection. But he's got this kind of... So the arm that he used to fire that blast, he's got... It's all... He pulls up his sleeve, and it's all covered in Kirby tech, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And
you wouldn't
places.
Even know that. Yeah, you're right. You wouldn't even know what it was. You just
he says some
technical device there.
Yeah, he says this is. He holds it up to Thaddeus, and it's doing the little ping, ping, ping. It's like I said before. It's way smaller than the Mother Box and Forever People, but he says this was what was in my bag. It looks like a box, but it has a strange power in it. So it's almost like he either doesn't know or doesn't want to tell what it really is, but it does give us a connection to the other books. So.
Yeah, and meanwhile, Steel Hand is meeting another dude and decides to arm wrestle a huge robot.
Yeah, it's like the over-the-top sequence.
Yeah, it's Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah. But yeah, it's still no match for the Steel Hand.
No, he smashes it up. And then Mr. Miracle comes in to break this little meeting. And more inner gang enters the room. And they capture Mr. Miracle. Easy. They knock him over the head, knock him out. And strap him to a missile, just like Captain America kind of thing.
Yeah, they're surprised that he's alive, because they don't know someone else is wearing the costume.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm sure you could guess, even if you didn't read it, Scott Free. And they strap him to the missile, because he's basically like, you know, we got that bet. We still haven't settled the bet over the big trap, so let's do it.
Yeah, they still think it's Thaddeus, but yeah. we all know it. Thaddeus is dead. It's Mr. Miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses his mother box again to escape before the rocket launches into space. So he's free before the rocket launches.
Yeah, and it explodes.
And much like in Batman, Tim Burton's Batman, where Jack Nicholson is in the chair, he shows up in the... Mr. Miracle shows up in his chair, Steel Hand's chair, and he tries to crush him and uses his all kinds of other things that he likes to point his fingers. And it seems the Mother Box can do various things. In this case, he blasts the steel hand, and then he's got like jetpacks. In this comic, he doesn't have the cool gliders on his feet, but he's got like jetpacks shooting out of his back.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually makes a compact cocoon spinner, which he like launches out of his hand, and it kind of like marshmallows the steel hand.
Yeah. Takes them out.
And then the cops show up. It's the Scooby-Doo ending. We've caught you.
Yeah, actually, going into this reading it, I didn't really realize that we were going to get a changing of the guard, such as it were. I didn't realize we would start... I didn't know that actually going in, that we'd start with one Mr. Miracle and that he would die. And then we could pass on.
And you see that later on, too, with... In the 80s or 90s when Scott Free passes it on to that other kid. I can't remember what his name is.
Yeah, me neither.
But it's a very similar thing.
Yeah. I liked that in the last panel, the little last panel preview of the upcoming issue. Kirby shows that he can use alliteration just like Stan Lee. It reads, "And so the act goes on to other satanic and sinister situations simmering with mounting magnitude to juggernaut jousts with the super escape artist's greatest adversary, death." That's some alliteration worthy of Stan Lee there.
Yeah, I enjoyed these. Looking forward to the next batch. Which, are they all Jimmy Olsen, or what are we going into now?
No, I think there's Jimmy Olsen. So, yeah, so coming up will be Superman's Pale Jimmy Olsen 136, The Forever People number 2, and The New Gods number 2.
Ah. All right. Sweet. I'll probably read that over the Thanksgiving break.
Yeah. Sounds good.
And finished Contest of Champions.
Yeah, I didn't... I'm still going to finish up the rest of those Night Force issues. Maybe I'll read those for next time.
Yeah.
Get to it this time.
The one thing I want to start soon... I don't know if you have them, but you were talking about reading Doom Patrol. I was going to go back and read the first appearance of Doom Patrol.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't have them, but
I'm gonna be talking about that coming up here soon. Cause I'm really interested. I like the Doom Patrol.
Yeah, they're very. I guess I haven't read a lot of their stuff, but they appeal to me because they're so quirky and strange.
Mm-hmm.
So. All right.
So. Of these, I enjoyed the Kirby stuff the most of everything I've read. but I also enjoyed those that third issue of Blood Pack a lot.
Yeah.
And I was just revisiting Contest of Champions.
Yeah, I started off this, already warm to Kirby, and it was like, it's appreciation for his... how much he did for the 60s Marvel stuff, all the characters created, but I think this will be, this podcast will be chronicling me turning into a Kirby fanatic. I just think, you go in and you look at just how much he created. I think just the nature of how people were credited in the days that he did a lot of his work.
It was very false.
Yeah. And so even though some of that has changed and he's gotten more credit than he used to get, there's still a vagueness about attributions that probably won't ever go away completely. And I just think, in terms of the amount of things that he created and how enduring and part of our popular culture is. I feel like there's not many comic book creators that you have to list on the level of, like, some people might think this sounds ridiculous, but I don't think it is really, like, on the level of, like, Shakespeare or just these, like, almost immortal artists. I feel like he's kind of on that level in terms of the degree of his contribution.
Oh, I think he's a... For me, he's miles above. Like, I can't name anybody that's even close. Do you know... Because he wrote Andrew. That was, like, very rare. Mm-hmm. And when you look at what Stanley jotted down, he really was a storyteller, which he doesn't get. I think Stan gets a lot of credit for story. But what he was is an outliner, I think. And then Kirby told the story.
Yeah. I don't know that Marvel would have... Like, Stanley definitely had the mind for being a publisher and being a promoter and being
and imagining things, right? In other words, coming up with concepts, great concepts, and letting somebody else take hold of them.
I think he was integral in getting those concepts out there and getting them recognition and type of thing that he's continued to do throughout his life. So I wouldn't say that Marvel necessarily would have dominated the 60s like they did, and that, you know, the creations might not have had as gone as far, but he's definitely had his due and his recognition, you know. So I don't have a problem. People are trying to emphasize how much other people did, Kirby and Ditko and stuff like that, because it sort of balances things out, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows Stan Lee, you know. Stan Lee has done a great job of promoting Stan Lee. He doesn't really need any help.
Right.
You know. But Kirby's gone and Ditko is hiding in his apartment. You know, so.
That's another thing I want to dive into. I have the DC Ditko archive or whatever. And I'm not real Ditko literate, to tell you the truth, other than, you know, what he did for Spider-Man.
And same here.
So I'm interested in diving into that just to explore something different.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I mean, no surprise when it comes to, you know, I know his Marvel stuff and not his DC stuff, and I know pretty much his Spider-Man stuff. I went back and read a ton of old Spider-Man years ago. Because even though I feel really disconnected with Spider-Man in the present day, but Spider-Man was definitely my favorite character when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I still feel a connection and affection to him because of that, but I just feel disconnected with him nowadays.
Right.
I don't know. People tell me Dan Slott stuff is good, but I don't know. I can't get past the... like, there's certain things I just have trouble identifying with. Like,
yeah.
I kind of want, you know, I don't have a problem. I don't expect comic books to cater to me. I don't have a problem with, but I guess because Spider-Man's the thing that I connect with from my youth, that's the one that's harder for me to...
Accept change?
Yeah, like I'm interested in finding out, you know, about a continuation of the Spider-Man I read when I was a kid, so I want to see... You know, I don't want to read another version of Spider-Man as a single guy. I want to read what it's like for Spider-Man to be older and married for quite a few years. And, you know, like, and I'm not going to sit here. I'm not going to go on the internet and flame people on message boards because I understand why I'm not getting that, you know. But if they, you know, if that's what it was, I'd probably be buying it.
There is a Jack Kirby, in the next previews, a Jack Kirby, another omnibus coming out. And it's going to be really interesting because if you're a fan of the Superpowers toys, that's what it's going to focus on, is his superpower comic tie-ins. So
I noticed that it has those in there because I think those volumes are basically collecting everything that's like all the random stuff he did, right?
Yeah.
Outside of the main titles, like the Fourth World stuff and OMAC and Demon, Commandy, all the stuff that they've already collected.
I'm excited for that. That was one of the ones that I was like, wow, they're going to do that? I'm like, that's awesome.
So, yeah, it's nice when they finally... I noticed they also solicited a Green Lantern trade. I think they're calling it... I forget what they're actually calling it, but it's Green Lantern first series from like the issue numbers in the 170s. It's like Len Wein, I think, stuff. Because there's a huge gap of Green Lantern stuff that's not collected. I got a lot of the issues. You can get them fairly cheap. I already have the issues, and so I won't get the trade, but I'm glad that they're, because there's a huge gap between the Green Lantern, Green Arrow stuff and the start of the second volume of Green Lantern. There's a huge gap of stuff that's never been traded, so it's cool to... I was happy to see that.
Yeah.
So, well, I guess we should wrap this up.
Yep. So, we are located at geekbrunchpodcast.com. You can also find us at Facebook at Geek Brunch Podcast, and then you can click the like button. And I think we're going to be posting a lot more retro things on there. I posted the Fairchild commercial because I was just fascinated by it.
Yes, that was awesome. Yeah, that's why I created the album. Like, basically, I'm going to try to keep updating that, putting cover images. We have some...
Does that take a long time to do?
I thought it was going to. I had the idea a while back, and I was procrastinating. And then when I actually did it, it didn't take that long.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I, you know, I like some of the, I, you know, the, like, pages on Facebook that I follow. There's like the Fourth Wall and where they put albums up of old comic book images and stuff. So I thought it'd be cool to do.
Yeah.
If you want to take a look, you like the Facebook page and we have an album there, you can look at, you know, we'll have a few in the show notes, but if you want to see covers of all the comics we talk about and maybe in the future some other stuff too, like Mike said earlier, some maybe a retro ladies.
I want to do that. I really want to put that together. I think it'd be very interesting.
So yeah, I want to put. We need more people like on the Geek Brunch page.
Yeah, and we're also on Forum for Geeks. Scroll down to Geek Brunch. You do have to sign up to see stuff on this forum, don't you? It's not like the old forums.
I think. You got to sign up to post, but I think you can actually view.
You can view without signing up. So yeah, you could go view stuff, but we'd like you to participate, and it doesn't take long to sign up. Usually a day or so, and then you're able to post.
Yep, you'll be able to. You can also post on.
Yeah, and let us know what you want to review. Like, you reviewed some Invaders, and we had that request a couple episodes back. And
let us know what you're reading.
Yeah.
Back issues that you're collecting.
Or toys that you played with that became illegal. I have one just recently that did the Bucky Balls.
Oh yeah, I saw those listed too.
I used those as a stress reliever at work.
Oh right, yeah. You see them all over the place.
Yeah.
Everybody had them.
And it was a real weird thing because I bought my own. My friend had one that I always used, but I bought my own like 2 months or 3 months before they became a hazard. And they went from the price of $30 for, you know, for the little cube of Buckyballs to $5. And then you knew the company was in trouble.
Why did those get banned?
Because people were swallowing them, and you have to surgically remove them.
Oh, yeah, that was right, because they're magnetic. And
yeah.
More than one, and they would adhere segments of their intestines together.
Yes, yes.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
That should be like a... They should... I was thinking like earlier, like there should be like a lawn dart killer. You know, like, you could have like somebody that forces someone to ingest... Buckyballs.
a new supervillain like, team, Lawn Dart and Buckyball.
Yeah. we're the banned toy brigade. sounds like, actually, it sounds more like a Tales from the Crypt episode, though.
All right. So on Twitter, you're Mythmaking ETC, etc.
Yep.
And I am Mike Myers Brunch. And you could always hit us up with questions or comments there, too. And help us guide this show.
Email mike@comicbooknoise.com.
Yeah.
I'm mythmakingetc@gmail.com.
Still trying to get your account set up.
Yeah, that's cool. I do have a recording.
I have a request for the forum, but I haven't got a reply yet. I might have to hit somebody else up.
Yeah, I did. I got my license, so looks like Pretty May recorded the whole thing this time.
Cool.
So yeah, but yeah, once I guess does it gets kind of silly until I have actually access to the database or the server, you know. But you can let me know some.
Yeah, I'm gonna release this one pretty soon, just because the holiday, you know. I want to edit it and get it out.
Nice. Yeah, I was. It was awesome, the turnaround you had on the last episode. I wasn't expecting it till the following weekend, and I was on the internet like, holy shit, it's already up.
All right, well, you have a good week.
Thanks, you too.
And we'll talk.
Yeah, have a good holiday if I don't talk to you.
Yeah, have a good Thanksgiving.
Thanks, you too.
All right, don't get play with any illegal toys during, you know, with family. No lawn darts.
Yeah, if there's Bucky balls on the Thanksgiving table, I'm going to pass on those.
Yeah, pass on them. Don't swallow them.
Yeah, that's our message for this episode. Our the more you know.
Yeah.
Don't
grow on. No.
Yeah. Don't eat buckyballs.
Yeah.
During Thanksgiving dinner, even if they look tasty.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you.
Watch
later.
Out for flying lawn darts. All right.
Have a good Bye. One. Bye.
You too.
Mattel's wonderful Thing Maker. It makes creepy crawlers, spiders and lizards, snakes, dragonflies. Make them yourself with this nice plastic goop. Choose a mold, pour in the goop, eat it, and presto change-o! You've got bugs. Squiggly, squirty bugs. They feel so soft and natural. You get four different colors of goop and special paints. Make charming lizard pins or spider rings. You can collect them or spread them around. After all, they are fun for the entire family. Get Mattel's new Thing Maker with creepy crawlers. You can tell it's Mattel. It's swell.
Oh, I was just passing by. slide till you come to the river and then drop in. Where's Crab Tree? Brought you some flowers.
Oh, aren't they pretty?
I brought you some candy, too.
Why, Norman!
Hey, how did you get in here?
Oh, I just flew in.
Jackie, will you please excuse us?
You, but the snake? Hey, Pansy.
Well, what do you want?
As you go out, pull the curtains, will you? This is private. Read it.
Oh, Norman.
Don't call me Norman. Call me Chubsy Upsy.